Sanghe charang soke chok namla, jang cho badu dagni kyab su chi, dagi chun yen gipe sonam ki, drola penche sanghe drubha shog, sanghe charang soke chok namla, jang cho badu dagni kyab su chi, dagi chun yen gipe sonam ki, drola penche sanghe drubha shog, sanghe charang soke chok namla, jang cho badu dagni kyab su chi, dagi chun yen gipe sonam ki, drola penche sanghe drubha shog. So okay, as the Buddha says, and I love this quote, I quote it all the time, and it's a way of framing all of Buddha's teachings from A to Z, is that a bird needs two wings, wisdom and compassion. So clearly the compassion wing, which is really the political wing, it's the action wing. What do you think politics means? It's for the people, action, action, you know. There's no question. But, as the Dalai Lama says, compassion is not enough. You've got to have wisdom. And wisdom sounds a bit abstract for us, but it's just common sense. You've got to have common sense. So compassion is the wish to help others. But that's not what makes you capable of helping others. That comes from wisdom. This is really powerful. And the more we can see, understand this wisdom wing, as we've talked, and what that is all the nuts and bolts of Buddha's teachings, thinking about karma and thinking about the mind. That's all we've done the last 2 days. That's the wisdom wing, basically. Putting yourself together. And the consequence of that is you become this steady, reasonable, grown-up, content, fulfilled, less neurotic, less ridiculous person. That's the person who can then open their eyes and go, oh my God, we're all in the same boat. We can't see past our own nose if we haven't put ourselves together. We're just totally overwhelmed by our own misery. That's clear. And then when we do try to help others, we make a mess because we're seeing everything through the lenses of our polluted compassion, polluted by our attachment. We mean well, but we make a mess, you know. So it's got such logic to it. And when we get this, we can really hear it, you know. So clearly, the Buddha's view of the wisdom we can cultivate is like insane. If we compare with even what we even use that term in our culture, which we don't. But we have got the capacity to have unbelievable wisdom. Wisdom about how things are. Wisdom about our own nature. Wisdom about the world. Wisdom about other people's minds. This is very abstract for us, you know. I mean, our medical system and even our psychological systems, they demand that we ask questions of the patient. I'm not being critical now. I'm just looking at our system, which is externally based. You know, a doctor has to ask you questions. And a psychiatrist has to ask you questions. But a Tibetan doctor will look at... Well, there's a good example of this. One time we did a book in Wisdom when I was working there in the 80s that was about Tibet and in the early days, in the 70s when they started coming to the West. And one Tibetan doctor, one of the marvelous doctors from Dharamsala, who are like lamas, they're thoroughly versed in Buddhism, but the Buddhist psychological model and the Buddhist view of karma are completely integrated into the medical system. Completely integrated. It's based on this, actually. So anyway, because it's based on the Vajrayana, the most sophisticated level of the Buddhist teachings. So anyway, this doctor, who'd been one of the Dalai Lama's doctors, was invited by a regular young MD who did the rounds of the hospitals. The young doctors do the rounds of all the patients, you know. So he was given one old man to assess. So he didn't ask a word. He didn't have a word of English. He sat there for 45 minutes feeling the man's pulses. And then he gave a complete description of the man's health from the day he was born. The doctors were impressed. So what I'm getting at is it's a totally because they can read your mind from this. They can read the karma you've created. They know exactly, and they can read it because that's the system. This is such a sophisticated system, and this is coming from India. It's amazing. China's similar. Nothing like this in our culture. I think we did once, we've lost it. So the same with psychological model. You don't need, I mean, the Buddha's view, like I'm saying, you know, yet, during the time we've been talking, you can, Lama Yeshe is not joking, he says, be your own therapist. We learn to know the actual, our own cognitive process. It's not just, that's too vague for us. We are convinced that we are this way because of what did in the past. We have to look for needles in haystacks. We have to go back into the past. That's our model. What did your mummy do? What did your daddy do to you? What did the Catholic nuns do to you? What are your genes, your DNA, your chemicals? We even look at the grandma and grandpa. That's not the view in Buddhism. You can look in the past, nothing wrong. The Buddha says look into your mind. We don't get that because we don't understand the mind in that way. It's so sophisticated, I'm not kidding. Like as if I know anything, I can actually have a view like that. But from the bit I do know, I can say that. We need to learn to know the workings of our own mind. And when we do, you can't imagine the wisdom we can cultivate. First level of the wisdom is you get clairvoyance. That's like hilarious for us. But that's one of the natural consequences of meditating. The natural consequence of getting single point of concentration. Natural consequence. You can get it in a couple of years if you work hard. Because you access a more subtle level of your mind that doesn't depend upon the brain. That is beyond conceptual, beyond the sensory. We don't posit such a thing. And this has been around India for thousands of years, and these techniques are unbroken and still living. You can get clairvoyance. What does that mean? When you've accessed your subtle level of consciousness, it has the capacity, because it's subtle, to cognize phenomena that are more subtle. Like what? Like the past, like the future, like the minds of others. All this fits completely, is coherent in this model. So seen in isolation, it sounds like wacky science fiction, you know, but it fits in the big picture when you study the big picture. So wisdom is unbelievable. Like I gave that story, I don't know about Lama Yeshe helping the monk, didn't I? Did I tell that story?
Yeah.
That is because of the wisdom Lama had of clairvoyance, not to mention compassion, what was best for that person. That's powerful. But that's an example of wisdom with compassion. We'll discuss that again tonight. Maybe you didn't hear it, you know. So first of all, if we've got the compassion wing to help others, what's compassion? Got to analyze, got to define our terms here. So right now, okay, what Buddha says, the compassion wing is all the good qualities. So compassion is like an essence, the essence of all of them, you know. Even you can talk about love and compassion. That's the essence of all the other good qualities. Summarizes. So what are the definitions of love? It's very clear. Remember we said in the last 2 days, talking about the mind, it's a conceptual story. It's a concept, a thought. So love begins with the thought. May you be happy. That's what love is. You can narrow it down to that. It's may you be happy. When you see someone happy, you delight to them. When you see them, you want them to be happy. That's profound. So the virtuous states of mind, and this is what we're describing here, are necessarily other-based. That's why they're so profound. The delusions that we've got to try and get rid of are I-based, necessarily. Neurotic, I-based, panic-stricken, fear-based, ridiculous states of mind that cause all our suffering. So the wisdom wing, the degree that we can even lessen a little bit of the delusions is the degree to which we can have some compassion. You grow both simultaneously. So what's compassion then? Well, that's the flip side of love. If you see suffering and you go, oh my God, that's terrible. May they not suffer. You wish people don't suffer. You have empathy with others suffering. That's compassion. Bare bones. And of course you grow these. And all the methods on the bodhisattva path are methods to grow these. Not just keep it flat. And that's one thing about spiritual teachings. We don't think you kind of grow something. You know, if you're practicing the piano or you do math, it's an incremental process where you become a musician, become a mathematician. We don't think of spiritual teachings as growing. When we do a compassion meditation, we think I'm supposed to get a gooey feeling, you know, but next minute you want to punch your boyfriend. No, it's a gradual process of growing these things stably, coherently, constantly, to the point where they can't be reversed. That's the real point. Ongoing, you know, step by step, step by baby step, wisdom and compassion. So love and compassion, other-based. Now, let's analyze our compassion. Who do we have compassion for? Normally in our world, with respect to us, I think we have compassion only for innocent victims. Think about it. Analyze. Think about it. Think about yourself, whom you have compassion for. And that, I'm being a little bit sarcastic here, that probably comes down to a few children and a few animals. Right? I mean, who has compassion for a lion? Nobody. But the little mouse, maybe the mouse, not sure, we don't like mice, so probably not. Probably we have compassion for our pussy-wussy and our doggy-woggy. That's about it. I mean, the others we call vermin. Who has compassion for cockroaches? Nobody. Who has compassion for mice? No. Rats? No. Skunks? No. Rabbits, as long as they behave nicely and don't interfere with us? Yes. So, as long as animals don't offend us, we're happy to have compassion for them. Well, that's not compassion, that's sentimental attachment. And when we've got too much attachment for them, and when they get stuck in this little pussycat that we think is so gorgeous, starts costing us money, we think we're being kind, and we quote-unquote put it down. Excuse me. We kill it. This is pretty outrageous. We should look at our compassion. It's kind of limited, you know. It really is quite shocking. It's based on attachment. It's based on attachment. Based on attachment. So we're trying to see compassion here unadorned. Not polluted by our attachment. And this is what we discuss, you know. It's hard to hear this. So of course in the beginning, the compassion we have, it's not possible to have it without attachment until you've got rid of attachment. It's obvious. But we can begin to have some attachment that when we understand even intellectually, theoretically, these terms and these states of mind, we can begin to practice having genuine compassion a little bit, step by step, baby steps by baby steps, you know. So what is compassion for the Buddha then? Well, not just for innocent victims, or indeed, what, as another way we'd put it, we'll start framing it in this way, we'll put in this framework, not just for our friends. You know, in the compassion meditations, when you do the classic kind of the different little techniques that have been cultivated over the centuries, passed back, you know, like passed back in the lineage, the different traditions that have been passed back, right back to India, the methods for cultivating bodhicitta. Bodhicitta is the culmination of compassion and great compassion. It kicks in and becomes bodhicitta. So bodhicitta, the Sanskrit word, somehow I think the English translation makes it so boring, so we just got to get used to bodhicitta. It's like awakening thought. Like, yeah, it's great. Who wants awakening thought? But that's what it means. So bodhi is another word, is like bodhi, Buddha, awakening. Another term they talk about, Buddha is awakened, fully awake. So awakening attitude. So it's this powerful, outrageous state of mind when you've got bodhicitta, which is the culmination of all these little techniques we're going to go into. We're going to discuss it here briefly in the context of one technique, which is a combination of the two main ones that have been traditionally passed down in Tibet. One is called the six causes and one effect, and one is called the exchanging self, or known as mind training, or known often as exchanging self for others. So there's a combination of these two techniques that consists of 11 little techniques, the culmination being bodhicitta. And we'll discuss it in this framework. So the first of these, and this is fantastic, we'll spend the whole evening talking about this one, it's the starting point. And it's called equanimity. So this is also, this is an equanimity, this is used in different contexts in Buddhism. So in the junior school and high school, in the system of first scope and second scope, in the first stages of the Lam Rim, in the wisdom wing, that's the wisdom wing, as we've been talking the last 2 days, karma and the mind, when you've accomplished to some degree this, which is when you begin to get some renunciation, having practiced junior school and high school, having practiced abiding by the laws of karma and being your own therapist, getting some renunciation of suffering and its causes, then you have some marvelous equanimity. And that equanimity is a stability in your own mind. Where instead of being up and down like yo-yos, all of us, and we are up and down like yo-yos. I mean, I say these terms sometimes and people are a bit shocked, but you know, like I say, we're all mentally ill, it's a question of degree. It's really true from the Buddhist point of view. Because klesha, affliction, mental illness, is a good translation for all the rubbish, you know. Also, I say we're all bipolar, it's a question of degree, and I don't joke about that. Because if we analyse more and more the Buddhist view about attachment and aversion, we're going up and down between these two 1,000 times a day. And if we're really extreme in our attachment, we'll go up, 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 and we'll go crashing down to despair. That's what we mean by manic depressive. That's what we mean by bipolar. Of course it's more complex and there are more variations of it, but technically using Buddhist views, that's it, you know. So we're all up and down like yo-yos. So when we've got some equanimity, that's when we've got renunciation. When you understood attachment and you're not so clinging to up and down people and things and attachment and this and sex and drugs and rock and roll and approval, you're more stable in yourself, you're more, therefore more content, more fulfilled, more joyful within yourself. Who doesn't want that? My goodness. This is blissful. That's what you get from the first stages of practice. That's equanimity there when you're stable. Here, the equanimity is defined very differently. This is a specific attitude in relation to sentient beings. And we can hear the logic of it. It's the same logic we've been learning in the wisdom wing. Now it's referring to sentient beings. So as far as this view is concerned, Buddha's view, there are only three categories into which all beings on the planet will fall into. There's no fourth. It's really clear. Those that are the object of our attachment, those that are the object of our aversion, and those that are the object of our indifference. They're called friends, enemies, and strangers. Think of a fourth category, you won't. There won't be one. It's very powerful, this, and this is Buddhist model, isn't it? Attack the three toxic emotions. Ignorance, attachment, and aversion. So again here, ignorance, the particular aspect of ignorance that they're talking about here, not the absolute ignorance, not the ignorance called maripa, ego grasping, which we're going to talk about probably the weekend. Not that one. But an aspect of ignorance, one aspect of this deep ignorance, is that we don't care. About, for whom? For people who neither harm nor help us. We adore our beloveds, whom we're attached to. We can't stand the people who aren't kind to us. And we don't care about those who do neither. This is the way the universe is. Join the universe. There's nothing special. Monkeys and dogs and ants and humans are all like this. Because what's interesting to us is Buddha's psychological model refers to all sentient beings. It's very powerful, very coherent, and very consistent. You'll see. So we hear that this equanimity practice then, it's marvelous. It's the foundation for beginning to develop, grow, step by incremental, love, compassion, great compassion, bodhicitta. Step by step. You've got to go step by step. From here to bodhicitta is too high. It's impossible. It's like from here to understanding relativity in one leap. That's absurd. Step by step. So okay, what's equanimity? Well, this is my way of putting the definition. Equanimity, when you've got it, will be this heartfelt recognition that friends, enemies and strangers, the objects of our attachment, the objects of our aversion, the objects of our ignorance, friends, enemies and strangers, that they are equal to each other from one point of view, that they each equally want to be happy and don't want to suffer. So in equanimity, we're trying to prove that to ourselves. We're trying to prove that to ourselves. It's so powerful. So also we're contradicting, hugely counteracting ego's absurd views. Because wanting others to be happy, that is what love is. And wanting others not to suffer, that is what compassion is. So right now, the only ones we want to be happy, that is to say love, are our beloveds, the object of our attachment. They're the only ones we love. In fact, we conflate love and compassion. Love and attachment. We only have attachment for those we adore, and we only love those we have attachment for. That for us is just normal. No one questions that. And that's why this even meditation, starting the first of the 11 steps, is a shocking concept, you know. We're trying to shift us from that absurd ego's non-logic, illogic. So right now, we only want to be happy, those who make us happy. And that is those we're attached to. We don't want those who don't make us happy, to be happy. That's our enemies. We mightn't use the word enemy, but it's a convenient label here for anybody we have aversion for. Often we say, oh no, I don't have any of those. Well, don't be ridiculous. The people who annoy you even slightly, that's an object of your aversion, right there. You don't have to hate them. But within a group of people, if you spent one day with a group of people, it will be divided clearly into ones you like, you don't like, and you don't care about. I promise. It's like that. Automatically, because that's the way samsara is. It's how we are. So right now, without question, we do have love for some people, and we do have compassion for some people, and it's the first category only. generally speaking, the world, you know, generally speaking, we can be brave and try and have compassion for strangers and enemies, and that's what we're trying to do. But here we're talking about ordinary world that never questions these things. We adore, we love and have such compassion for our beloveds, those we're attached to and those who are attached to us. So it's mutual, you know. That's where our love and compassion exists, in that group. Until they give you up for a younger version. And then they will go quickly into the second category called enemy. And your love and compassion turn off like a tap. Effortlessly. I promise. And we all know about that. And no one questions it. And so the third category, who are they? I mean, we can't even look at them. They're so boring. We've got to get our head over here to look at the strangers. And who are they? Well, that's 99.999% of the universe. I'm sorry to tell you. 99.99999% of the universe. And who are they? They're called strangers. Why? Because they neither harm nor help us. And how do we think about them? We couldn't care less. With respect to us. They could drop dead. Half the universe could fall into the sea. Or to the earth. Probably be all wacky out of balance then. I know that. But just imagine. We don't care. Naturally, because we don't even know about them. Even now we do know about the world. You read about some country, huh? You have no idea. Because it's not your people. It's very simple. I always quote this story. In my New York Times, I opened up one day on my iPad in the home, down the home page, and on the right-hand bottom, the heading said, 350 people die in ferry accident in Tasmania. Well, Tasmania is this little island state just off the southeast coast of Australia, and they have ferries going every day to Melbourne, right? It's like, oh no, you know, my people, right? Australia, even though I'm American as well. I was born there. So I went, oh no, and I looked, and it said Tanzania. Not Tasmania. No. And I went, oh, that's okay. I mean, I felt that. Do you understand? And of course I caught myself and read the story and had compassion. Of course I did. But immediate. Not my people. I thought, Tasmania, where's Tasmania? Oh, yeah, it's Africa. And whereabouts in Africa? And I looked and I read it. Of course you have compassion. It's easy to do it if you try. But automatic. My people, you know. We all understand that. It's natural. It was very funny, wasn't it? I mean, it's just funny. I caught it, you know, in Tanzania. Oh, no, I said. I'm visualising all the Tasmanians in the water, you know, between Melbourne, all my Melbourne people, where my family are from, in the water between it, you know, wherever that piece of water is. I don't know what it's called. Do you understand? It wasn't. It was Tanzania. It's very fascinating how we all are, right? So let's you look at some of the... And this is where these meditations are very interesting. We use logic. People think compassion meditation love all about gooey and having tears, you know. I had a wonderful meditation. I cried for sentient beings. I'm very happy for you. And the next minute you're mad at your boyfriend. That's sentimental rubbish. That's not compassion. It's got to be rooted and grounded in wisdom and strength and courage. And it's not based on some wishy-washy feelings. It's based on understanding. And we have to break through and cut down ego's ridiculous misconceptions. We've been doing that in the Wisdom Wing. We keep doing it now in relation to others. Wisdom Wing is about ourself. Wisdom Wing is all about ourself. Do not ever think it's not. And it's powerful and utterly necessary. You cannot have compassion until you've got some semblance of wisdom. You cannot have compassion before you've got renunciation, which is the first main realization from the Wisdom Wing work. And what's renunciation? Like I said before, it is two things. Renunciation is you're beginning to give up suffering and its causes. First and second noble truths. So you've got to know what... So now we have to go back. If we've got compassion and it's for the suffering sentient beings, then I've got to know what a sentient being is and I've got to know what suffering means. Back to high school, the Four Noble Truths. What is suffering? Well, Buddha describes three levels. First one is the one we all know. The suffering of suffering, Buddha calls it. And what's that? That's when the bad things happen. And that's the only one we know about when it comes to suffering for ourselves. And it's the only group of people we have compassion for as long as they're innocent. When the bad things happen, we have compassion for the victims, the people who are raped, the dogs who are kicked, the people who are starving, the people who are sick. Who's ever thought of having compassion for the rich people? Nobody. Who's ever thought of having compassion for the happy people? Nobody. Who's ever thought of having compassion for the bad people? Nobody. But that means we've only got a narrow, tiny view. So by the time we come down to it, our compassion is miniature for just a few dozen people. Buddha's talking about compassion for every single sentient being. It's like mind-boggling. So we've got to understand the logic of that. Back to high school. Sorry. And junior school, which is karma. So Four Noble Truths. There is suffering. First one. Three levels. First one, suffering of suffering, when the bad things happen. Second level of suffering, which is very, for ourselves, is very depressing and is very freaking, very freaks us out. The second one, Buddha calls it a subtler, heavier level of suffering. And he calls it merely the suffering of change. But what he's referring to is what we call happiness. I mean, we think, Buddha, what are you on about? We can't even enjoy our chocolate cake. So we've got to understand what he means by this. And this is not that easy. And we only can understand it by understanding attachment. And the third kind of suffering, even more abstract, called all-pervasive suffering. So it all fits in the logic of the big picture. So the first kind of suffering is the result of harming sentient beings, which is based on anger. The second kind of suffering is the result of it is caused by attachment. And the third kind of suffering is the only way it can be annihilated is by realizing emptiness. So you cut the ignorance. So if you want to stop the first kind of suffering, having bad rebirths, being badly beaten, being abused, being attacked, being insulted, people not liking you, people not believing your words, people not paying their debts. You name it, look at our lives. We all have that kind of karma, and that's the third one called experiences, similar to the cause. If you don't want those anymore, stop doing them. The logic's pretty clear. Buddha says, you know, if people lie to you, it's because you've lied in the past. If people don't believe your words, it's because you've lied in the past. If people don't give you credit, it's because you've stolen in the past. If people give you things, it's because of generosity in the past. This is really basic. It's the third track of karma. And this is a basic way of understanding karma. Forget lower realms and higher realms, even. So we know we don't want to be abused. We know we don't want to be poor. We know we don't want to be sick. We know we don't want to be lied to. So tick all those boxes. You just go to the 10 non-virtues, tick, 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 and I say, okay, I will not do those. Solution concluded. Next life, you'll be cool and happy and rich. Simple. It's the Buddha's view. You know, we're in charge, babe. There's no punisher. There's no rewarder. There's no account book. We're in charge. Such a shocking concept to us. We keep looking around who's running the show, you know. We are. Better get used to it. So if you know what the first kind of suffering, the suffering of suffering, give up harming others. Hardly complicated. You don't want the second kind of suffering, give up attachment and the rest of the delusions. You don't want the third kind of suffering, realize emptiness. You want to get out the lot, get rid of that. That's the message. That's Buddha's message. That's it, you know. So, if we're looking at compassion for sentient beings who are suffering, they're called the suffering of suffering. That's all the poor people and the sick people and the raped people and the abused people, the ones we can have compassion for. Because as far as we're concerned, as long as they're innocent victims, then they deserve our compassion. You've got to deserve it. Make sure they didn't harm anybody before. As long as they're innocent, we're happy to have compassion for them. Only them. Second kind. He's really referring to anybody who's driven by the delusions or join the universe. That includes the happy people. That includes the pedophiles. That includes the Mr. Trumps of the world, if you don't like Mr. Trump. Some people might like Mr. Trump, and that's perfectly fine. You're allowed to. All the bad politicians, all the maniacs, all the ex-husbands, all the meanies, all the rapists, all the druggists. You name it. The mean people. This is a shocking concept to us. Why should we have compassion for them, we ask? Because they have just begun their suffering. Bodhisattvas have more compassion for the pedophile than the victim. This is very hard for our minds to hear. They wouldn't really have more. They have equal for everybody. But the person who's just suffering now has just finished the suffering due to their own past karma. The person doing the suffering has just begun a whole new set of lifetimes of suffering. That's a bit like the compassion of a mother for her junkie kid. Nobody can stand that junkie kid. She vomits in the soup, she steals, she lies, she's a pain in the, as we say in Australia, a pain in the bum. But her mother, she has such compassion for her, Why? And this is the point. Because she sees that she's harming herself. And that's the basis of a compassion that we have to cultivate. Everybody who harms others is brutally, brutally, brutally harming themselves. As well as others. Yes, of course they are. But this, we cannot get that level of compassion, literally cannot, until we've got it in the wisdom wing for ourselves. This is serious, you know. We cannot understand this compassion until we understood the first and second scopes. We cannot understand that level of compassion until we have renunciation of ourselves, understanding karma, the law of karma, and why I'm suffering, why I cause suffering, why bad things happen to me, and why I cause suffering, and why all this stuff. That's all explained in the Four Noble Truths, which is in the Wisdom Wing. If we don't get that, we haven't got renunciation, which means we haven't got compassion for ourselves, which we haven't really given up suffering, and we cannot have this level of compassion. There is no logic otherwise until we understand karma. This level of compassion is impossible without understanding karma, which we learn in junior school. So it's tough. It's a hard one. You know? I mean, if you're a Christian, there's a valid reason to have compassion, because God loves everybody. That's incredible. That's amazing. Materialist view, I don't think there's any view we've got. With respect to our views, there's no real logic in our psychology, in our neuroscience, in our views of the universe. There's no basis for us to have compassion for people who harm us. Interestingly, we always look to see what happened to them. I mean, we do that ourselves. We go back to our psychiatrist, our therapist, and we go back into the past to look for what happened to me to try and explain why I hurt people, why I get angry. Now, we try to do that for everybody, but we don't like to forgive that person. We think they're still a monster, you know. It's very hard for us. And the Buddhist basis for having compassion is very simple. It's the view of karma. But you will not have it. You can't have it. Even theoretically begin to think of it until you understand karma properly for yourself. This is fact. It's like you can't understand fifth grade until you've done fourth grade. It's the same here. Because compassion wings are more advanced. So it takes time for us to think this one. If we don't think about karma, it's a really intense one. It's hard to get to. So the Buddha's deal is, you know, reminding us of karma. Every single sentient being, every dog, every ant, every monkey, every human, every other being the Buddha would assert exists, are experiencing necessarily the fruits of our past actions. Every tiny good thing that has ever happened to us, we should be blissed out every day. But tragically, we never think about those because we think we deserve good things. And so, you know, give me more, please. But we cannot stand the pain of suffering, of having bad things happen. And I think I want to talk about this here now too, because this is very much still a part of how we can really get compassion. Looking at the deepest assumptions of attachment and aversion. This is quite hard, very hard actually. And it's only if we really understand the Buddhist view quite well. I mean, excuse me, I'm not saying I understand it quite well, but a little bit. We have, deserve is a very heavy word for us. And I'm sorry to say in this country, I'm allowed to say it, I'm an American, I'm allowed to say it. I've been here 25 years. I'm allowed to say it. And I have a passport. And I'm a citizen, so I'm allowed to say it. I notice that when I work with people in prison, the vengeance and the resentment and the bitterness, you've got to earn love and compassion. You've got to earn. You have to deserve. So we think people deserve to suffer. They're one thing wrong. I've got a friend on death row. Not on death row, sorry. He's not on death row. This other one, he's an old man, now 85, 86. I just helped finishing his memoir. He's on the New York State. Some small county where he murdered a girl 56, 57 years ago. He's the longest serving prisoner in New York State. He's white, nice guy, you know. But he was kind of very suffering and demented when he was younger, very tortured and suffering, and his mind was kind of crazy and everything. Nice guy. But he killed this girl, you know. But because in that particular village, that town, that county, whatever, that they since the first time he went for his parole in 82, the sheriffs went around with to sign to keep a killer in prison. So that's kept the momentum going, and he's been turned down 20 times by the parole board. And it's all very kind of village-like. It's not really, you can see it's nakedly not justice. Nakedly. They say he hasn't ever earned his, he's got 5 degrees in prison. He's worked every single, he's done art, he hasn't stopped for 56 years. years in prison helping other people and accomplishing things and getting degrees and doing this and being a painter and doing that and studying Buddhism and leading Buddhist groups all his life. And he's 86 now, becoming senile even, you could see. And they still won't let him out, you know. So if that's not vindictiveness, that is the heaviest thing you can hear. Because this person, 20, you know, 56 years ago, okay, you know the karma of it. The karma's interesting. But it's looking at this heaviness of deserve. So we have this powerful assumptions in our mind, I think. You look at attachment. We don't analyze this, but it's actually, if you want to bring attachment right down to bare bones, it's deep in our being. And it's the deepest of the deepest assumptions that we never even notice and never question, that I only deserve good things. And aversion is the outrage that I don't deserve bad things. If you think about that, it's so profound. And you've got to analyze why, if we think, you see, in other words, if you deserve something, isn't it, with deserve, would you agree it implies that someone else has to do it for you? Would that be right? So I deserve something. I deserve happiness. I deserve love. I deserve money. I deserve care. It's implying someone should give it to us. Would you agree with that? And if you look at anybody you know who's got, and is very suffering, who's got lots of attachment, lonely and sad, there's this terrible sense that it's not fair that no one loves me. It's not fair that I don't get anything. We recognize that, don't we? That's attachment when it's most painful. But you have to analyze deserve. Deserve implies that you did something to deserve it. And that's the thing about prison. When my friend Jim, he did that, so he deserves to suffer. And no one is going to change that. So it's a flip side, you know, you can see it. The heaviness of that. It seems to me the prison system here, particularly because it's so strong, is like it's built on that, on aggression and arrogance and deserve and anger. In other words, it's based on anger. Keep Buddha's psychological model. It's so simple, it's embarrassing. It's called anger. It's called anger. It's called anger. You think about it. Anger wants people to suffer. It's very fascinating. So anger, aversion, is how dare you do that to me, and indeed, how dare you do that to him. It's the same thing. That's anger. And attachment to ourself, of course, is I deserve whatever. I mean, we think it, but have I created the cause for it? Well, I don't think I should create causes. I just deserve it because I got born. That's what we think. It's very bizarre if you think about it. I use the example. You know, like if you've got a bank account, nobody looks in their bank account and says, how come there are no dollars in my bank account? I deserve dollars. Nobody says that because you know it's your bank account and you're the one who did it. You're accountable. Kind of look, you know, egg on your own face. There's no dollars in there. Nobody ever would say, as if there's someone else, someone should be putting dollars in your bank. That's how attachment thinks. Someone should be making me happy. That's how sad and suffering attachment is, how schizophrenic it is. No wonder we're all crazy. Think about it. That's attachment. An assumption that you'd better make me happy, and he'd better do that, and you must give it to me. I must get it from out there, because why? Because I don't have it here. I'm empty. I'm nothing. This is a nightmare of it. It's a tragic mental suffering. We just think it's normal. And then when it doesn't get what it wants, or when it gets what it doesn't want, that's called anger. People think I get angry. I just get excited. Are we communicating here? It's kind of a powerful, you know. So anger is this outrage. And we think it's healthy in our culture. Ooh! So when these young Tibetans, in 2003, I always quote this, when Richard Gere invited His Holiness to New York in 2003, and I was working in the prison project then, and we were discussing, collaborating, whatever, but in the end he invited 20 former prisoners, all of whom had done some kind of meditation in prison, and then people like me were invited. It was a wonderful day. They met His Holiness, they talked all day about their suffering, the dramas. It was a cross-section of Americans, you know? A few white, a few black, a few pink, I mean male, female. Don't seem to be many Asians in prison in America. I have to say there are a few. We didn't have any Asians. But there's American, white ones, black ones, male ones, female ones. I'm sure they didn't talk about non-binary back then. I'm serious. And then Mexicans and, you know, Puerto Ricans. Bunch of people suffering. Suffering, yeah, real suffering. In prison, garbage dumps, treated like animals, blah, 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 whatever their suffering was. All talking about lots of tears and wonderful conversations. They met His Holiness. It was a wonderful day. And they invited two young Tibetan nuns. So these women, young women, 20s, tortured and sexually abused for a couple of years in Lhasa, in Tibet. And they eventually got out and they were in India and now they were invited in America, whatever reason. I don't know what they're doing there. Young women. Talking about their suffering. Now, probably the Americans, probably, if you want to quantify suffering, you could argue those Tibetan nuns' suffering was more than most people's. You could argue that. People could, you know, was having... But the key point I think was so shocking to Americans, to us Americans, was they weren't angry. And we don't trust that in our culture. We think they're hiding something. We think they're suppressing something. But listen to this. Because they had the view of karma, and the view of karma has been in Tibet for 1,200 years, it's been in Asia for 3 or 4,000 before that, but we know nothing about that in America, of course. We don't know about India. We only know about, we go back to any history, we go back to the Greeks, that's about it. What do we know about India, Africa or Asia? Zero. I mean, look at us. White people. It's white people, I'm sorry, you know. It's very fascinating. We know nothing, only Europe. Europe's our fancy place, you know. That's it. Africa? I don't know. Asia? Who cares? These funny people. India? Even more weird with their red dots and everything. Do you understand? White people are very narrow-minded, with respect. We are. So anyway, India, what do we know about it? These geniuses back then. I can't even describe these geniuses. They discovered the mind internally. They mapped the mind internally, you people. We can map the brain, maybe. That's pretty clever. They map it internal with a microscope of their own mind. They're geniuses. They can develop clairvoyance. They discovered it thousands of years ago. So it's fascinating. So anyway, raving on here. So what am I saying? This view of karma is thousands of years old. It's been the worldview for thousands of years. And it's the crucial component of Buddhist philosophy and psychology, you know, in the big picture point of view. Karma, that how every sentient being creates their own reality. There's no creator concept. That is just acceptable by them. They're not panic-stricken by that. They're not going to be sent to hell for that. Although every time I get into a taxi, people recognize I'm Buddhist by certain fundamentalists, whether they're Christians or Muslims, whoever, and they, in the end, they're going to pray for me. I say, yeah, please pray for me. Because they all think I'm going to hell, you know, whatever. I mean, because you don't believe in a creator, right? So anyway, there's no concept like that. It is a philosophical view that does exist in the world called no creator. So it's not so shocking. It's just how it is, and that's the Buddhist one. So it's a pretty outrageous view. We create ourselves. Self-creation is as holiness the Dalai Lama calls it. So anyway, these young women are brought up with this. It's in their bones. Like, in our bones is the view that money made us and our mind is the brain and, you know, that one. That's our view. That's what we're brought up with. We take it as a given. Like they take that as a given. Now the point is this. Because they had the view of karma, they had the view that every sentient being has had countless past lives and will have countless future lives, that every sentient being has any happiness because of their past virtue, and that any sentient being has suffering because of their past non-virtue, and join the universe because we're all in the same boat. There's no difference. There's no difference. We've all done that, all been there, done that countless times from the Buddhist perspective. Those women, that's in their mind. They know that people cause suffering because they've been harmed before. They know that you get harm because you've caused suffering before. They know you get happiness because you've caused goodness before. They know this. This is just their view. It's their view. It's inbuilt in their brain and their being. It's infused in their view. It's just who they are. That's what they think. So of course there's no anger because you listen to anger. How dare you do that to me? I don't deserve it. That's not the view you have if you have the view of karma. Because you know why something is happening to you. So you don't even have to process the view of anger. They don't even have it. This is hard for us to hear, but it's logical when you unpack it. So they immediately know why suffering is happening. They immediately know why happiness is suffering. They're not pulling their hair out in rage like we do, and that's the suffering we can't get past. We can't get past, why do bad things happen to me? We can't get past that question. And what I find fascinating, that's the question we ask. The torture of when bad things happen to us, that's the pain is from that question. And in philosophical view of our universe, there is no answer. Christianity has its answers. Islam has its answers. At least that's already, God got a plan, and you know he's got his plan. At least someone's got a plan. Do you understand? So you can accept that. That's understandable. That's fantastic. But the materialist view, and I'm nothing wrong with it, we're amazing, science is amazing, all what it's doing is amazing, but there's no view about that yet, so no wonder we go mad. Because we can't get past, why do bad things happen to me? We can't find an answer, and that's why we ask it, because we want an answer. So all we're doing here is dealing with Buddhas. No one has to believe it. I mean, that's just my working hypothesis. And I can see in my own life, being an angry person, fundamental change. I don't get angry with those things anymore because I've got this new view. I've internalized that view. That's become my view of the universe. So I don't have anger about those things anymore. I don't pull my hair out in rage. I don't ask the question why anymore because I have the view of karma. So it's like very peaceful. It's a huge view. Karma is a huge view and it is the basis of compassion. So these young women, then, this is the point, finally, tears, this suffering, sexually abused, tortured, couple of years. And they said, well, one of them said, and of course, we had compassion for our torturers because we know we must have harmed them in the past and because we know they will suffer in the future. That's the basis. That's compassion from the Buddhist perspective. Now you've got to get there. And how you get there is starting with karma, you know. There's no shortcut. There's no logic otherwise. It's based on logic. Buddha's logic, you've got to accept that logic because it's the internal system that we're discussing here. All systems have their own internal logic. They're all contingent on this and that. If you want to learn African music, you've got to have a certain system that's got its own logic. Acupuncture's got its own logic. Allopathy's got its own logic. You can't force these logics into each other. So Buddhism's got its own logic, the whole system, and it's up to you to jump into it and take it as a hypothesis. That's your call, you know? That's what I've chosen to do. So when you have the view of karma, when you really practice it, you do not get angry. That's it. It's logic. But you've got to do the work to get there. Another example. My friend Jigdrol, more than 30 years ago, from Lhasa. He was one of the first of the young Tibetans in 87, with the first uprising since 59. And there was all the young monks and nuns. They were the radicals, all demonstrating. So in actual, we think, demonstrate anger. No. They know why it's happening. They understand karma, but it's still wrong. Doesn't contradict that. It's still wrong. So they fought for their rights. They're amazing. So brave. So courageous. Got murdered. Got imprisoned. So he was first imprisoned. He was arrested in a demonstration and got imprisoned and tortured. Then he was released. Then he demonstrated again. Then his friend had his head blown off. Then he thought he'd better escape. So he came to Nepal. He was at Kopan Monastery. And he was telling me about the suffering, and since he'd left, his father been murdered, brother been murdered. And he was sad, tears there, tears. And I said to him very casually, I hadn't really thought enough about karma at the time. It's like 40 years ago maybe, I can't remember now, 35 years ago, I forget. And I said to him very casually, I said, Jigdrol, do you ever get angry? And he laughed very casually. Well, being there, what for? It's our own fault. Now that is such powerful words for us. It's colloquial. He just meant it without going, oh, it's all karma, blah, 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 giving a lecture. It's just his natural words for it. It's our own fault, meaning we all created the cause. We know that. So why bother? You know, we know that. You can get on with dealing with it. That's the point about this view. You cut completely that torture, that drama, that suffering, that mental breakdown of why. And then you have to learn to let go of the why because you can't find the answer. And then maybe one day you might heal it before you die. Whereas this one, they bypass anger. They don't have the view because they know they have an answer why. Can you hear my point? I mean, we don't have to accept the view of karma. Just like those Muslims, they're Muslim, that's their view. This Muslim couple, I quoted that one yesterday, day before, who are totally devoted to God. God has a plan. They're not worried. They're not asking God to expose his plan. They trust him. He keeps it in his pocket, and that's fine. That's their deal. I have faith in God. So, how are you, their daughter had died in a flight. How do you feel about the death of your daughter? We are peaceful. She belongs to God and he has taken her back. I would never criticize that view. That's sublime. That's pure. That's the pure, correct view if you have faith in a creator. But look at most Christians, especially in this country, excuse me, ranting and raving and blaming and wanting death row and you know, I mean, extreme, demented. I mean, sorry, I'm not saying Buddhists are so holy, but you put your money where your mouth is. If really God does have a plan, really God is real and God has a plan, then God knows what he's doing. Then relax, enjoy your life, please. And shut up and stop complaining. I'm serious. It's the same with karma if you're a Buddhist. Put your money where your mouth is. Really study it. Really think about it. Really apply it every day. It's intense. It's got to be done seriously. You can't just say, oh yeah, karma. What do you mean by karma? Oh, I don't know. Cause and effect. Tell me about it. Oh, I don't know. That's no use. Got to know the nuts and bolts of it. Like we talked one day anyway. So compassion's based on this view. What I'm saying is attachment and aversion would be gone, diminished hugely if you have the view of karma. That's how powerful that view is if you really apply it, unpack it, unravel it, apply it, give it, put meat on the bones of it. Don't just say empty words, oh it's karma, that's essenceless, that's meaningless. Then that would, it counteracts the assumption of attachment that I deserve happiness, even though you didn't do anything to deserve it, you just got born. And I don't deserve bad things, even though there's no logic to show you didn't deserve it. We just assume it's my right. And that's self-existence. That's concrete view. That's the result of ego grasping. That's the assumption of ego grasping. It's monstrous. So you know with your bank that if the dollars are there, you deserve them because you put them there. And if there are no dollars and you don't deserve because you didn't put them there, unless somebody came and stole your money, that's different. Same with your garden. Who put weeds in my garden? You don't say that. You know it's your garden. If there are weeds there, baby, they're your weeds. So these are simple examples. So when you have the view of karma, your life is your garden. So when you have this view for yourself, it is easy peasy, falling off a log easy to have compassion for the maniacs and wackos and Mr. Trumps of the world and the racists. And the wackos, and the rapists, and the terrorists, and the Mr. Who knows with the Weinsteins and whoever those lot, you know. And Mr. Trumps who grab ladies, you know what. You will see people. It's not easy to say, I'm saying it easily, but when you have a view of karma, you work on this, you know. So then, see, all the other misconceptions, compassion's kind of wimpy and soft and full of tears. No, when you've got compassion based on wisdom, it has got iron in it. It is powerful. Driven by wisdom and understanding, so you know where people are coming from. You wouldn't be a stupid fool. It wouldn't be sentimental compassion. It'll be wise compassion. And compassion just means not being nice to people. It's doing what's best for that person. That's the real compassion. Having enough wisdom to know their mind, to know what is best for that person. Not just what you think is nice for that person. That's attachment compassion. That's pathetic. Are we communicating here or not? Yeah. Full on stuff, you know. And of course you don't say all this to somebody who's weeping, who comes to me and just been abused by their husband for 20 years. I say, give him a lecture about compassion. No, not possible. Or even about karma. I'd support them 100%, hug them and say, how dare that monster harm you? I would accept their story and I would agree with them. It's only when you've grown up in yourself can you hear this stuff. That's a fact. Got to know where a person's at. But you came for the teaching, so I'm sorry you got me. You with me? Okay. So compassion, right down to equanimity. We haven't got anywhere near compassion. That's like ninth step. I kind of leapt to it, you know. Let's go back to equanimity. Keep us on the ground. For equanimity, you start, this is the ground, this is the basis where you make this fundamental shift in your view about whom you love and whom you have compassion for and the reason you love them and the reason you have compassion. Now, ego's reason is because they make me happy. That's it. Ego's reason is because they make me happy. Here we're shifting it to, it's because they want to be happy. And we're proving that everybody wants that. So this is profound already. We're shifting, it's got logic to it, equanimity. Everybody, so now let's try and prove logically how what we call enemy, friend and stranger are the same from this point of view. It's not too difficult intellectually, it's just emotionally not comfortable. So okay, I'll use an example. I need a boyfriend. I don't know. I've had several boys over here. What's the man in the corner behind Andre? What's your name? The man with the dreads. What's your name?
Baron.
Who, darling?
Baron.
Baron. Say it again. Your
Baron. Like the red.
Barry. Barry.
Baron. Like the red Baron.
What?
Like the red Baron.
Oh, Baron. Okay, Baron. 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 Or Baron. Australians. Baron. We open our mouths big, you know. Baron. Okay, Baron's my boyfriend. Okay. Okay, so this, you'll see the logic of this. It's very clear. So let's say I've never met Baron before. That means he's a stranger. Maybe he's a bloke that lives, I was talking my same story, he's a bloke that lives down at number 7. Let's say he just lives down at number 7. And he's in Rosewood Lane, in Carey, a couple of houses down from Robbie. And Robbie's his friend. And I've seen him every now and again when I go into Robbie's, because Robbie's where I live for the last 22 years when I come to Carey, Riley. So and he tells me, you know, Rabina, this poor Baron down number 7, you know that bloke? He gets terrible migraines. And because he's Robbie's friend, I'll say, oh, really, the poor fellow, I'm so sorry. And it'll last about 30 seconds, and then I'll go past the sugar, Robbie, and carry on talking about myself. And why? Because he's a stranger. Now, we know what migraines are like, but I don't know the man. That means he's never harmed me, and he's never helped me. That's why I have indifference for him. Do you understand? Like the Tanzanians. That's why I have indifference. Because he's never touched my life. We don't ever question. We should be mortified by this. But we don't question. It's normal life. Everyone's like this. So then that's the end of it. And then he introduces me to Baron, and then we fall in love, and he moves me into number 7. Right? Possible? And overnight, what category does he now into? He's now called friend. And I adore him. Because I've got attached for him now. He's suddenly the most intimate, real, divine person in my whole life. I will sacrifice my life for Baron. I'll stay up all night. I'll buy bucket loads of drugs on Robbie's prescription. Rabina's so compassionate. She takes care of Baron. She spends so much money on his medicine. She's got compassion. Oh, Rabina's so compassionate. She's so loving. Why? Because he now loves me. He's attached to me and he thinks I'm gorgeous. So of course I want him to be happy. I mean, it should be embarrassing for us, but this is how we all are. No one questions that kind of love. And it's too much to even ask. It's too embarrassing to hear this level of love, because it's the only love we know for people who adore us. He adores me now. He's attached to me. He thinks I'm fantastic. So my love and my compassion, which are there, are suddenly flooding outwards. Fantastic. At least I've got some. But it's only for a friend. I'm getting to a real point soon. It's coming, this story I have. It's coming. Now let's say he's bored to tears with me, chucks me out, and he moves in, I don't know who. He moves in, potentially he's a lay girl, you know, like me. And what were you before?
Jeanette.
He moves in Jeanette, when she was a lay person. So now what category does Baron fall into? Overnight he's in the enemy category. How do I feel about his migraines now? I hope he suffers. I mean, am I not right? Is this not the world? Is it not normal? It's normal, right? And we don't question. So the point is this. This is the conclusion in my ridiculous little story. You know, let's say you go around and you're doing a survey about migraines, and you knock on the door of Barry's house at number 7 while he is my stranger. That's my label. He doesn't say, I'm a stranger. He's just called Baron, you know. He just feels like Baron. So you ask Baron how his headaches are when he's my stranger. He will tell you they're unbearable. Now you knock on the door of number 7 when I've moved in, where he's now suddenly my friend. How will he tell you about his migraines? No difference. And when he's an enemy, when I've moved out and Jeanette's moved in, he will tell you the migraines are just the same. So it is obvious that enemies, friends and strangers are the same in from the one point of view that they don't want suffering and do want happiness. Proof is right there. But because we have these three labels we put on people, we should be mortified at how self-centered we are. We do it to the universe and we believe they're real. We believe in our label. We really believe in our label. So attachment labels friend, makes them look divine. Aversion labels them ugly, called enemy. And stranger labels them boring. Therefore, like, we couldn't care less. We should be embarrassed to admit to this, but this is the universe. And here, we're trying to smash past this in relation to sentient beings. Or you can reverse it the other way. Let's put these three, let's put three different people now, right now in your life. You know it right now, you've got some people who adore you, even maybe one. You've got some people who can't stand you, and you have some person, at least you can point out at work or at home somewhere, who for whom you're a stranger. So put yourself in, you're the one person, now these three people are looking at you. Now you know, if they wrote down a description of you, you wouldn't recognize the same person. The friend would say a divine person, the enemy would say a horrible person, and the stranger would say a boring person. You wouldn't recognize you. You don't recognize because they put their three projections onto you. They're putting their projections onto you. One thinks you're divine, one thinks you're ugly, and one thinks you're boring. You with me? But you know it's not your reality. You're not thinking, I'm a friend, I'm a stranger, I'm a friend, I'm an enemy. No, you're just you. Think about it. It's the same logic. You know then you as a stranger 1 second. You know that you as a friend 1 second and you as a stranger. There's no difference. You don't want headaches all the time. You want to be happy all the time. Well, friends, enemies, strangers out there that we project onto. Complete fantasy made up by our own minds. There's no basis. The only basis is what you do for, whether you fulfill my needs, and that's the nightmare, that's the monstrosity of attachment. As we see the universe in terms of whether you fulfill my needs. If you do, you're called nice and you deserve my love. If you don't, you deserve hell. And if you do neither, you just don't care. You can drop dead. I know I'm extreme, but it helps sometimes to be extreme. Aren't we communicating? This is how the universe works. And here in the Bodhisattva path, here in the wisdom wing, we're trying to smash the three delusions in relation to things to help us become strong. Now we're being really radical and looking in the universe in terms of sentient beings and to get beyond these labels so we can begin to have equal love and compassion for every one of them. I mean, it sounds exhausting. Look at how much hard work it is just to love one person. And that's only because we've got attachment. If we didn't have attachment, it'd be easy. And that's what we're trying to do here. Are we communicating here? Good. Time for questions. Come on. 8:04. Thank you, Baron. For being my friend, enemy, and stranger. All three at once. Go on, questions. Questions. Anything. Yep. Mic here. In front of you. Yep.
Hi. What's the best practice to realize emptiness if you're like a lay person?
Okay.
And you're not a monastic.
That's not the topic tonight.
No.
No. Compassion is the topic tonight. That'll come the weekend.
So what's a good practice to develop compassion?
Well, I just told you the last hour. This is exactly the answer. This is the beginning of how to get compassion. Did you hear any of what I said?
Yes.
Then there's the answer. Do the wisdom wing first, understand the delusions, understand, get yourself together, understand karma, lessen your own suffering, and now we can go to the compassion wing and start to see everybody's in the same boat. We have to develop this powerful, strong compassion and wisdom. We've got to get past the delusions and get to see how everybody's equal, and then we can start growing it from there. We've just begun the process by talking about equanimity. Do you understand? We talk about emptiness on the weekend. I don't know if you plan to be around.
I'll try.
Needs more time. Okay. Yeah, someone else.
Hello, Rubina.
Hello there.
Say, I just want an observation, then a question. I was just thinking back that I had the opportunity to see you probably about 20 years ago at the old Kadampa Center.
Oh, yeah.
And I want to thank you for continuing to come back.
Pleasure, pleasure.
And also thank Don and Robbie for creating this great center.
That's right.
But I was thinking about karma, and it concerns me of what I might have done in lives past.
Yes.
So I guess I know you've given us a lot of tools and techniques, and you're talking about doing the work.
Yeah.
But is there a way, if I've done some bad things in past, to head it off and not
That's
let
right.
it happen at all?
Absolutely, yeah. We're getting the weekend. I'm sure we'll talk about that too. But we did discuss that on the day we discussed karma. As Lama Zopa says, the very first level of practice, first level, entry level, junior school, grade one, immediate, is at least attempt to stop. Sowing more negative seeds so we stop harming others. This is the first level of practice. And the next step is to purify the karmic seeds we must already have planted before they ripen as our suffering. And that's the purification process, the four opponent powers. Are you familiar with that?
Well, you've talked about that.
And if we can live our life with at least avoiding harming others and doing some purification every day, really that is a sublime life that you will have. You can add a few extra bits to that, but you've got a fundamentally good life, and you can have a happy death and get a happy rebirth, guaranteed, even with that much. But then also we should remember to rejoice in all the good things we've done, the fact that we've got good qualities and a good life and have a reasonable human body and people like us and have good friends and we have family and we get credit. This is a fruit of our virtues, and we should never forget that as well. All the good things that ever happened to us, we tend to take those for granted, but we must not. That's also the fruit of your incredible virtuous karma, and that makes us very happy and more courageous and want to continue to practice. Do you understand?
Yeah. And one other thing about compassion, though, I was reading an article about a physician. Sometimes they can have too much compassion and get overwhelmed.
That's right.
I guess your observation about that?
Absolutely. That's the compassion that anybody in service helping people have. Unless we really looked at our minds, that's compassion mixed with attachment, and that's why it destroys us. Because attachment, and we discuss that in depth, but attachment is this hunger to get only the nice things. Basically, it wants only the nice things. Attachment can only bear nice things. So if you're in front of suffering all day, your poor attachment will get exhausted. It can't cope. You get anxiety, you get tired, you get sick, because attachment just is not getting what it wants every second. Do you understand my point quite literally? Then it's exhausting. So if we've given up, we've got less attachment, we will never give up on compassion, and you will never get exhausted. So it's attachment to getting the nice things that makes our compassion, that drags it down and makes us exhausted. This is really a powerful point, I tell you. Do you understand?
Yes.
Good.
Just one other quick thing. You know, I was thinking about contentment.
Yes.
And what I like how you said to be content with where you are and what you have, but still aspire
absolutely
for more.
If you talk about the bodhisattva path, that's really the proactive view there, to have this constant aspiration, which is a very virtuous thought for something. I want to get out of samsara, to have renunciation. I want to give up suffering. That's not attachment. That's very powerful aspiration, and that's a cause to keep us going with enthusiasm. But being content at each step of the way is so important. Otherwise, we turn it all into just constant dissatisfaction. That's a nightmare.
So I guess, do you see it as a lot of self-talk? You know, I think about this little devil and this little angel, and you want
inside our heads, you mean?
What?
Inside our head, you mean?
Yes, exactly.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
The delusions are, I call them the delusions, my roommates, and all the crazies are in there running the show. We've got to bring out the virtuous thoughts a lot more, you know. They're all there, too.
So I guess we need to just look at life through the angel and not the
demon. We've got to have real optimism. And optimism, as Lama talks in his book, Mahamudra, about our true nature, which is so encouraging to know that that's what our nature is. So you can not look forward to it in a neurotic way, but be knowing you're moving towards that. That gives you enthusiasm and confidence. That keeps you very upbeat. And then with that courage, the more you identify with your good qualities and your potential, the more courage you have to look at the rubbish. If only we look at the rubbish, we'll drag ourselves down to despair. That's no good at all. We can't sustain ourselves. It's too much. It's too one-sided. We've got to see our negative things in the context of our marvelous potential. Then we're delighted to meet the delusions and work with them and happy to meet them and happy to go there. We're not scared of them.
Great, thanks. Just one other quick thing. You mentioned about homeless and, you know, doing good deeds. But I was thinking, what if I hate, you know, really detest somebody, but they want money. And so I give them money, but in my mind, I have a lot of ill feelings.
Well,
so
you at least created some generosity, better than hating, better than not giving as well. That's okay. That's better than nothing.
So the actions are better. It doesn't matter what you're thinking.
Well,
them.
Of course it does, but at least you did create the generosity. Was it out of a good reason? Was it a pure motivation to give them money?
Well, no, I don't want suffering, so I'm going to do good things whether I care about it or not. But
No, it doesn't quite work like that.
Is that the ego talking?
The main factor that determines the character of the action you do, which is to say the main factor that determines whether your action is so-called virtuous or non-virtuous, which in turn determines the seeds you plant, which in turn determines the future results, is your motivation. So doing a good action without a pure motivation is not a good action. To have a pure motivation. That's what makes it a good action.
So it's all right to be motivated because I want good things for myself.
I mean, the karmic view is really about that, and we shouldn't be ashamed of it because we will get the good results. So the Buddha's talking about how we have to have renunciation of suffering because we're sick of it. So that means you've got to be sick of your own suffering to want to get out of it. So you've got to be infused by not having suffering. It's a way of putting it. That's important. You don't want suffering. And the main emphasis in the first stage is the fact that you're sick of suffering. You're exhausted from suffering. You want to give it up and its causes. And that brings happiness. That brings the result of happiness.
Great, thanks.
Good. Thank you so much. Someone else?
Hello. One of the things that I like about the Buddhist philosophy is that you can actually apply the teachings on your daily life. So I'm trying to find a way to apply what you just discussed in the daily life. You know, like I understand, you know, we meditate on equanimity, like this is a stranger and they move, you know, back and forth. But in the real life, you know, I'm not sitting, and I'm not talking about like when I have an uncomfortable event with someone, you know, because maybe at that point I'm just focusing on karma, cleaning my karma.
Yeah, I understand. Just, no, it's easy to do. I mean, are you around lots of people in your life? Are you around different kinds of people in your life?
Yes.
People who are strangers?
Yes.
People you don't like, annoy you, irritate you?
Yes.
And people you like?
Yes.
Perfect example every time. Let's say, I mean, what kind of environment do you work in?
I'm a homemaker.
Okay, so then I'm just thinking of somebody that was at work and you go all have dinner together in a cafeteria. I don't know if people work in that situation. You might if you work at Google now. I don't know, sure. But, you know, like even if you're around people, like even if you have a big family party, there's going to be people you like less among some of the cousins, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So automatically you see your mind as you walk into the room, you're looking for a friend and you run, because we want to be comfortable too. So you go to a person you feel comfortable with.
Yes.
And then you see one of the strangers over there, the one of the auntie that no one likes.
Yeah, like in the gym or something.
Exactly. So you have to notice your mind. Already as you walk in, you've already categorized them into friends, enemies, and strangers. And the strangers you leave alone, the enemy, you just don't want to see them. The enemies you constantly avoid, and the friends you magnetize by.
Be mindful when I'm...
Watch that attitude.
Okay.
And if... You don't have to rush around purposely choosing out people to talk to, but if you, let's say you're going to sit, and say there is a place where you're all sitting down for some food, purposely maybe, without showing a big fuss about it, a person you know that other people don't like, or isn't very popular, that's powerful. And you do it very casually. You don't say, oh, I'm going to sit with you because you're, you know, because I'm trying to practice equanimity. You notice your mind all the time. Have you got kids?
Yes.
Okay. Got kids have got friends?
Yes.
I bet some of those friends you don't like. Is that true? Some of them are a bit annoying, you don't like them, they're a bit rough, a bit aggressive maybe, no? Most of you like your kids' friends mostly?
Yeah.
Oh, that's fortunate. But let's say you've got one of your kids has a friend you can't stand. Automatically you're criticizing your beloved child is so precious and that one's so revolting. You just have to say, excuse me honey, they both want to be happy. Right there, stops you in your tracks. They are the same. From their point of view, not from your point of view, but from their point of view, the ugly kid who picks his nose and is mean and your beloved who's perfect, they both want to be happy in the same way. Right there, you apply it. That second. Think they're just the same as each other.
It's a start.
No, that's equanimity, and we're discussing equanimity. That's how you practice it. Every day. We're talking equanimity here.
Mm-hmm.
That's precisely how you practice it. You catch your mind. And you can say they want to be happy, but then you act it out by going to sit with the stranger or the enemy instead of the friend. That's how you put your money away. That's where you practice it. But you have to recognize they're the same as each other. The key bullet point of equanimity is that enemy, friend, and stranger are the same as each other from one point of view, the wish to be happy and not suffer. That's the essence of that's the meaning of equanimity. That from our point of view, they're different, and from their point of view, they are the same. That's the point.
Yeah, I understand. I just want to find like the antidote, like the practical.
I just told you.
Yeah. Okay.
I just told you.
Okay.
I mean, that's one way of putting it. But
yes.
You've got to remember clearly what the point is. They're the same as each other in the wish to be happy and not suffer. So you immediately run to your kid and you get annoyed with the other kid.
Mm-hmm.
Recognize if he did nothing wrong, they're the same as each other, even though yours is adorable and the other guy's ugly. They're the same as each other. They both want to be happy. They both don't want to suffer. That's the point of equanimity. When you know that, then you can apply it by then going to the ugly kid first. Are you all right, sweetheart? Instead of your kid. Don't you understand? That's how you apply it.
Well, you know, like in a daily life and in a difficult interaction, it would be, you know, hard. So maybe just start with a stranger. You know,
well,
like
be brave. Even be brave and try it with a friend, with an enemy. Why not?
Oh no, I mean, I have enemies, but
that's what I'm talking about.
I work on the karma part with the enemy. So
that's good. Okay, good, darling.
Thank you.
Okay, sweetheart. Next, you grab that mic and you can go next. Somebody behind it, back there behind. Don. Don wants to talk. What do you want to say, Don?
So it's risky.
What? A risk? Okay.
Oh, it's risky talking to you.
I'll be kind.
Okay. Now, this has to do with equanimity, but this is years ago, the Sangi Tandu.
Honey, can you sort of lessen that southern accent? I can't understand. You have to hear it.
Years ago, we had a teacher visit here who was a Geshe, Sangi Sandu. And I think what he said, if I'm not mistaken, was that real spiritual practice occurs, and he's talking about our awareness, when we have a feeling arises in the mind. If it's a pleasant feeling, and this has to do with equanimity too. If it's a pleasant feeling, we grasp onto it. We want it. If it's an unpleasant feeling, we feel aversion toward it. And if it's like a blah feeling, you know, we feel indifference.
That's right. So
he's saying a crucial place for us in spiritual practice is to be aware moment to moment of our feelings so we can catch ourselves before we go off and cling to the friend or feel a hatred or aversion.
What he's talking about is the equanimity in the wisdom wing. He's talking about the equanimity in the first stages of practice, equanimity in yourself first. That's what he's talking there. That's practice in the first stages of practice. And then it helps later when you have to apply it to others. But that's exactly what equanimity is in the wisdom wing, in junior school and high school, in the first and second scopes, where you grab your mind and you don't follow those thoughts. That's equanimity in your own mind. But here, it's in relation to sentient beings. So yeah, your point is right, that's the first equanimity. And you can only, when you got that, you're more aware of what's happening, so then you can begin to do it in relation to seeing enemies, friends, and strangers.
And one other, since we're talking about emptiness.
We won't. No, we're not.
I know. Well, but question that has to do
we could
with
a little bit, depends on what the context.
Well, context is how does the view of emptiness enhance our compassion?
Oh, easy peasy.
Good.
Because you don't believe in your karmic view. Everything's our karmic appearance, Lama Zopa says. Whatever, okay, the way they talk in the wisdom wing, it's applying emptiness, it's implying emptiness. That the way everything appears back to us, as Lama Zopa says, the way the entire world out there, which is the world we occupy, appears back to us, is in the aspect of whatever is in our mind. So if attachment is in my mind, the person will look delicious. If aversion is in my mind, the person will look ugly. If indifference is in my mind, the person will look boring, let's say. So when you realize that nothing has an intrinsic nature, immediately those views are less powerful for you, and you realize that everybody's in the same boat, everybody wants the same thing, and because you're realizing emptiness, as Lama Yeshe beautifully puts it in his Mahayana, in this book, I'll just quote it for you if I can find it. No, maybe I haven't got my iPad. I can't search, can I? No, it's a hardback. He says, you know, he quotes one of the marvelous Dharmakirti or somebody. He says, you know, the view of ignorance has caused us to have the view of I, and that brings the view of other. So when, you know, and within that terrible gap, as Lama puts it, that's where all the suffering is. So as you're lessening the I, You're lessening the grasping at I. You're lessening attachment and aversion and ignorance. You're not buying into those views anymore. So immediately you're closer to others, automatically. So that when you look at the two wings, every time you practice more compassion, it weakens ego grasping. And every time you practice letting go of ego grasping, it strengthens compassion. They absolutely work together, automatically and immediately. Does that make sense? You sure? Okay. But each has to have its own antidote. You'll never get compassion by realizing emptiness, and you'll never realize emptiness by working on compassion. You can even lose bodhicitta, Don, until we realize emptiness, a certain stage of development. So we've got to do the immediate antidotes to each, but they absolutely work hand in hand with each other, automatically. That's encouraging. Do you understand? Okay, someone else.
So when you were talking about like the practice of equanimity,
I'll give one little way of analyzing, one bit of logic about analyzing, a bit of using logic to analyze how it's not a valid view.
And to analyze those thoughts as they arise when dealing with the people who are, whether friends or enemies or strangers.
Catching what you're thinking, absolutely.
Catching what you're thinking, yes.
And then your behavior as a result.
Yeah.
So, staying close to the friend and avoiding the enemy and not caring about the stranger.
So I try to practice especially with dealing with the enemies and, you know, doing things to you that maybe you don't want to do, but you know that it makes,
exactly, cause you
makes
them
happy.
Reaching beyond yourself. That's exactly right, yes.
But how do you reach, like, even when I am doing that practice and being...
So reaching out to a person you don't much like and purposely spending time with them because that's helpful for them.
Because I know it makes them, and it makes them happier.
Exactly. Okay, so good. Where's the question?
But internally, I still, like, intellectually, I can understand the things you talk about, that you know, this person is suffering, just wants happiness as well, and that makes sense. But then there's an innate feeling, which I guess is just the ego, that still feels like I hate this person. I do not want to be around them.
But that's okay. You can't imagine, you can't be a bodhisattva overnight. You're practicing. So that's stupendous. You're putting, by doing that action and reaching out to a person you don't like, even for a moment, you're putting an atomic bomb on your own aversion. It's so powerful. You don't, but you can't expect to be a saint first. You can't expect it to go away. But the fact that you go against it even once, it's a powerful antidote. It's incredible.
So that's something that will develop over time.
You just get better at it. And eventually, when you've got equanimity, you eventually go beyond those, you'll get less and less view of enemy, friend, and stranger. I mean, you'll keep away from a psychopath because you know the poor guy's suffering. You won't be foolish. You'll keep away from the python. Think, oh, now, equanimity doesn't mean, oh, they're all equal, aren't they, lovey-dovey, they all want happiness, and you pat the python on the head. I'm sorry, no, they'll take your hand. Mm. You're intelligent by now. You've got the wisdom. So you keep away from the wackos, not because you don't like them, because there's no benefit to hanging around wackos. It's not a sentimental thing. You run around with enemies on purpose. A bunch of people are kind of, some people are really crazy. So you don't go anywhere near them. But in your mind, you don't have so much aversion. You understand why they are, but you keep distant. You get intelligence. You don't just get sentimental. Do you understand me?
Yeah.
What I'm saying?
You've
got to use your wisdom.
With that, too, with using the wisdom and knowing when to use, when it's beneficial to be around another person.
That's right.
What if it's, if you... The disadvantage of being with that person is strictly the harm of, like, my own ego or my own...
Well,
like,
I mean, I've got to give an example.
Okay,
it's too hard otherwise.
So with somebody that is, you know, doesn't necessarily ever, like, harm me physically or harm any way that other than just...
Annoy me, or
like put me down, things like that.
I know, you don't go around trying to be with enemies just to make yourself get equanimity. You just live your life.
Yeah.
But you notice in your ordinary work situations, your home situations, your family, you notice these views coming up and you try to go against them as well as you can. You just be natural about it, you know? And if you're in a big situation, there are 46 enemies, you leave them alone. You have to go to every one of them. I want to try and practice equanimity with you, and you. No. I'm not saying you're saying that. But you've been trying to be natural about it. But catch your mind every time. Watch what you're thinking. In other words, you're forcing yourself here, too, to look at your basis, your motivation for why you even talk to anybody. Of course, we only use attachment. We only want to talk to our friends. Of course we do. Mm-hmm. We only want to do that because it's easy for us and it's easy for everybody and it's comfortable. So that's perfectly fine to have friends too, but even then with friends, when you, see right now, if you and I have a relationship, I do love you, definitely. I want you to be happy. But the basis is as long as you make me happy. So even in my relationship with you, equanimity can help me really profoundly, and I can stop, I can say to myself, no, I love him because he wants to be happy. I'll change the reason I love you, even in the relationship. That's powerful. So when you be around friends and people you love being around, usually it's because they suit your attachment. Mm-hmm. No, you want them to be happy, not because they suit you. So say this to yourself. That's applying equanimity even in a friendship. It's powerful. You shift your reason for loving them, which is because they want to be happy, not because they make you happy or whatever, which is the usual attachment reason.
And then when you're with someone who is like an enemy, that is it, like, is it good to say, like, I'll sacrifice my own enjoyment and happiness because I know it will make them happy.
Yeah, if you've got to do it. It's like, this is like tennis. You've got to play the way you're capable. You can't leap in and try and be like Federer when you're not capable. You do it once according to your capability, according to your level of what you're capable of. You've got to know your capability and be natural about it.
Okay.
Don't force it. You can't do that. And then notice it, and then you learn. You learn every time from it. You learn from your mistakes and you play, et cetera.
Yep.
You learn every time, and you keep moving forward. Do you understand?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay, good. Okay,
thank you.
Did you want the mic? Who wants the mic? Give me the mic. Any other questions back there? Yes, sweetheart. Back here, and here. Two mics are needed. Where's the mic, please? Over this side. Okay, you next, darling. Go.
Yes, I have a question about what is the limit between compassion and when you have to take care of yourself. Like, maybe I'm trying, for example, the wife of an alcoholic man. The wife?
Let's say you are the wife of an alcoholic husband. Yeah.
I have a husband and he is alcoholic.
And then you have to take care of yourself. Meaning what?
Yeah.
Meaning what?
I take care of him because I feel compassion for him. But in that process,
but how do you take care of him? What do you mean? Feed him his drink because he's too drunk or what? What do you mean by take care of him? Beat him up because he's drinking
and
he's so tired? What do you mean take care of him?
Like, for example, he is in jail because he drove, he was.
Okay, so then you go to visit him, you get exhausted and it's too...
Yes.
What are you saying? Compassion, darling, is a word that's referring to others. It's compassion for others. This first one is we have to know our own mind. We have to know where we are at. We have to know what we need. You can't pretend to be more than you are. So if you have to have a little weep and a good massage, then you do it with a pure motivation and have it and enjoy it and have a good sleep. You'd be intelligent. Bodhisattvas have got to the point where they don't need sleep, they don't need massages, they don't need time for themselves. I know that sounds outrageous, but highly developed beings don't have those needs. So we can't be there if we're not there. We have to know where we're at. And we do it accordingly. We don't do it with attachment. You do it with the wish to continue to be a better person. I'm going to have a massage. In the wish to be a better person, I'm going to have a good sleep. You do everything you do with a good motivation, which makes it a virtuous action. So it's like, excellent. You've got to be realistic and do it with a happy mind. Do you understand, darling?
Yes.
Good. Yeah.
So, it's kind of on the subject, but I took...
Kind of what? Off topic?
No, it's not really.
Okay.
But I took what you said to heart last night. So this morning when I meditated, what I do every morning, I meditated on, you know what, I'm doing better than I thought I was.
And you believed it?
Yes.
I believed
it by going through some situations and understanding that communication, when people communicate with me, it's about the sender. And I started believing the lie and forgot that I was doing the right thing.
Well done. Congratulations.
And so my question to you is...
Yes.
I have in various notes. I'm having trouble with my eyes right now.
Okay.
Cataract surgery.
Yes.
I could have swore in the Lam Rim somewhere the Buddha talks about, or whoever wrote it, Chenmo, talks about, despite what's going on around with you, stick to your guns. And I can't remember.
Stick to your guns. They didn't have guns back then, darling.
But trust your insides.
I hear Buddha say that. He doesn't talk like that.
Okay. I could have sworn I read it, and maybe you would know.
Never mind. So what's the question maybe from that?
That's it. Like, do you know what his... am I making...
That's called wisdom, darling. Like, you've got to know, if you're in grade one, you've got to know you're in grade one. Mm-hmm. If you even think you're in only grade half, you're in trouble. You've got to be accurate about who you are. You've got to know where you've come from, where you are, and where you're going. If you think you're more than you are or less than you are, which is what we tend to be, we're either arrogant or low self-esteem, we're demented. You've got to know where you are, no more and no less, then you will move along beautifully.
Okay, that's powerful.
It's called intelligence, humility, and self-confidence, all together.
Right. That's it.
Powerful, darling.
That's it. Thank you.
Go on, people. Yes. Who put their hands up? Over here, this person had their hand. You have to go again. No, wait a minute. Don't take it away. Leave him there. Oh. Then where's this one come from here? Here's one here. So give it to her. Give it to her over here. This lady here. With the rain. Here, this over here. Down here. Right here. And then you can come next, darling. Okay, go. Red jacket, you go.
I mean, yes.
Go, darling.
I'm curious about how it seems to me that is karma an integral part of building compassion and understanding of karma, or is it just a prop that bodhisattvas discard after they reach that state?
Say the question again. A bit closer to the mic.
I'm wondering how integral this understanding of karma is, because I heard in your talk, I was appreciating that you said it's a view that you can choose to have and you don't need to accept it.
Well, all views are what you choose to have. I'm just being generous. I'm just being spacious here when I say that all the time. All of these views are views we must choose to have or not. We're the boss. We're in charge of it. But I mean, if you want to be a fully grown Buddhist, a full Buddhist, karma's part of it. In fact, karma is such a massive part of the whole Buddhist worldview, Buddhism would collapse into a heap of utter absurdity without it. So in that sense. But of course, in the end, you can be a 1% Buddhist. You don't have to accept anything. I make that point all the time.
Well, that was my question.
Okay.
To me, it doesn't seem that bodhisattvas have a view of karma anymore.
What do you
mean? It's
been
discarded because
their virtue
becomes spontaneous.
No, darling, no, not
nature.
Like that. That's naive. Spontaneous does not imply you don't have a vision. A gardener who's a spontaneous gardener hasn't forgotten the laws of botany, have they? Mm. They're living in the laws of botany. Same with a bodhisattva is living in the laws of karma spontaneously. It no longer needs to be intellectual. They've got it. They understand it. It's the same logic.
Right.
Karma is one of the first levels of dependent arising to help us realize emptiness. You can't avoid it. It's so integrated into the whole Buddhist view, which is why my friend Jigdol laughed when I said, do you ever get angry? It wasn't even, oh, well, we don't get angry in Buddhism, really, because we have the view of karma because we are. Because it's our own fault. It was so spontaneous. So when you have these, this is the interesting point, when you are capable, when you can play Bach, you haven't forgotten the theories, you've integrated them. They're part of you. You haven't forgotten them. So a bodhisattva hasn't forgotten any of the theories, but they now are living the theories of emptiness, of bodhicitta, of karma, cause and effect. It's utterly who they are, and that's what we're trying to become. You don't forget it. That's nihilistic. Do you hear my point?
Yes, I do.
You do? You don't have to if you don't.
No, I hear your point, but that's the danger I was worried about, is that it's such an integral part of Buddhism that if it collapses or if it's based on choice and nothing, then you lose the whole thing.
Now I'm really confused. Now you're throwing me completely. What's that again?
The whole Buddhist thought would come crashing
down about
karma.
I would say the world view that in fact Buddhism is, it's a world view.
Right.
Are you with me?
Yes.
It's a view of the universe. Karma is an absolutely fundamental, integral part of that whole world view, without which Buddhism would collapse into a heap of absurdity. That's a fact. So where's the problem with that?
The problem is, I'm trying to reconcile that with Dalai Lama's, it doesn't matter what views or religions you come from if you're trying to become a better person.
Oh, okay, no. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about being a Buddhist.
Right, okay.
I'm being a Buddhist. I mean, if you can be a Christian, you don't need karma. If you're a scientist, you don't need karma. And Dalai Lama's right in what he's saying, but I'm saying if you choose to be a Buddhist, and you want to do full-fledged Buddhism to become a Buddha, you can't avoid the view of karma. That's what I'm saying. It's part of the deal. It's part of the whole story. It's like trying to say you want to realize relativity without knowing about numbers. It's not possible. It's a part of the whole. This is a really good conversation, so keep going while you can't understand it. Say why you can't understand what I'm saying.
I understand what you're saying. I don't think you do.
You wouldn't have that question if you did. So keep talking. Keep talking. It's good. Keep talking.
Well, I'm trying to get at the truth that is beyond all paths and conception.
Oh, thank you. Okay, now you think there is one of those, do you?
I don't think there's one of those. I'm just saying that to be liberated from all, I mean, it seems that you need to be a part of the Buddhist structure and thought to become a Buddha if you're on that track. You know, I don't know how the metaphors line
up. Okay, I think I'm hearing a bit what you're saying.
Yeah.
So here we're talking concepts. Everything is concepts. You agree?
Right.
So Christianity is presented as concepts. Science is presented. Everything is concepts. The Buddha's view is we live at the conceptual level right now. The world is conceptual. And the Buddha would even say karmically over eons of time, it's conceptuality that creates our causes, creates our lives, creates the hell realms, creates the God realms, creates our human bodies. That's the Buddha's analysis. It goes into great detail. Conceptuality is where we're at a very gross level. So we can have Christian concepts, and we can have emptiness, we can have Buddhist concepts, label them like that. We can have a concept called emptiness, labeled like that. They're all labeled, so what they refer to, what they shine a light on, the experience of those things, you can't give them a name. Once you've experienced emptiness, if it is emptiness, I don't care whether you call it Buddhist, it's not relevant. But maybe I would say, if you want to realize emptiness, the ones who are probably the best at understanding it would seem to be on this planet, the Buddhist ones. I would suggest that. But then somebody else might say, well, I have that view, but do you hear their view of emptiness? It's another view altogether. It's not the same emptiness. So when you do use the concepts, that's where we can compare with each other, and we can see if we're on the same track. And if we are, then it's fantastic. It doesn't matter what concepts you used.
Then that's what I meant by if. That's why it said bodhisattvas have reached the direct realization of that which is beyond concepts.
What, darling? They don't have what?
They have reached the realization experience of that which is beyond concept.
They've realized the experiential truth of that concept is a better way to put it. So when you start playing Bach, you have to have musical theory. You have to have there with a really rigid theory on your piece of paper, and you learn all the skills and all the rules and all the arpeggios and all the scales, don't you?
Mm.
It's very rigorous within that worldview, wouldn't you agree? That's not African music. It's not Chinese music. It's not even jazz. It's a very strict, specific framework of music with very coherent laws within itself. Do you agree with that?
Yes.
First. So then to play like Bach, you must follow those instructions. And then eventually when you are perfected at that, you can whiz your fingers up and down while smoking a cigarette and having a conversation. Because you're so genius. It's completely internalized now. It's beyond theory, isn't it? You could throw all the music away. You agree?
Right.
You agree. But you can never, you would, but you're simply experiencing the theory. That's the same with emptiness. That's the same with the bodhisattva. All the theories, first into conceptual, have led them to the one of non-self. It's led you to that. They're beyond the theory. They don't need it anymore because they've accomplished it. The same as you playing Bach. But you, out of your kindness, would be able to reverse the experience and write all those experiences back on a piece of paper so you can help someone else play Bach. The same with the bodhisattvas.
You could only write it in the music of Bach because that's what you were trained in.
That's everything's like that. There's nothing outside of some context. Nothing is not contextual. Nothing is not dependent arising. Any body of knowledge you get, it's got its own framework. Any thoughts in the universe, it's got their own framework. You can't get past that.
I guess what I'm saying is if Jesus and Buddha met each other,
yes.
Would they sense that they had the same experience and realization?
I don't think they did have the same experience.
Okay.
I'm not being arrogant. All I know is very clearly one time when I had some talk, Jesus does not talk about bodhisattvas. He does not talk about when you get reborn and reborn as countless bodies throughout the universe to help sentient beings. He says you get reborn in heaven with God. That's a very different view. It's very simple. It's a different view. Very simple.
Because you have a different culture and training is what I'm saying. It's like
but it's still different concepts. It's still different concepts. It doesn't matter what it is. It's still different concepts. He's not saying the same thing. That's not wrong or right.
Okay.
But he's not saying, Jesus and Buddha are not saying, many things they're saying the same, and it's good to find the common ground. Many, many, many things they say the same, but at a certain point they're not saying the same. That's really okay.
Okay.
And it's up to every one of us. If we want to follow these people, want to follow thoughts, want to follow systems, we look into them and see which one works for our minds. What else can we do? Are we communicating?
Yes.
Do you think?
Yeah.
Are you sure? Really sure?
I'm interested in the common ground.
I hear that.
Good that you're making
What's your name?
Distinctions.
Link. What's your name, darling?
Link.
Link?
Yes.
L-I-N-C.
K.
Oh, okay. Who called you Link? Your mummy. Has it got any further words at the end? No? Just Link.
Freedom is the last name.
Oh, really? How sweet. Well done, Link. I admire your mother for calling you that. Thank you, Link. May you find freedom.
Well, thank you.
From suffering and its causes. Yeah, go. Oh, you, no, it's her turn. She's been waiting for microphones, but go, darling.
A little bit back down to earth.
Say it's back down to earth.
Back,
it's all down to earth.
Back down to a few questions ago, connecting to what this gentleman said and this lady back here about how to put different things into practice and how to test our practice, which is what I heard. I have a very strong karmic connection with somebody that I have a very, before I practice Buddhism, I would call a curse through.
You couldn't stand the sight of him.
And so I want to cure the curse. I want to stop the
having a relationship with this person.
Yes. And
is there something in this
purify.
Life that, is there something in this life they've done to you, or is it just you don't like them?
Yes. Yes. This
they've
life.
Just,
and,
they've harmed you.
Yes.
Okay.
And previous life.
Never mind that. You don't know about that, but it's possible. But no, you harmed them in the past life. Don't worry about it.
Yes. That too.
So they've harmed you now.
So now that I have this karmic
view,
I have a very strong desire to change that relationship.
I understand,
And so...
I have to ask a question. Change the relationship or change your view of the person? That's a very big difference.
The karmic connection, I guess.
You want to change your view of the person.
Yes, I do want to change my view.
You don't want to go in and become all lovey-dovey with them and have them huggy-huggy and forgive each other. You don't want that.
No.
You want to change your view.
Yes.
That doesn't follow that they're going to change. So you want to change
I want to change my view.
Not changing the relationship.
Okay.
It's changing your view of this person. It's
changing
a very big difference.
Changing my view.
Good.
And then? The future, you know, because
that'll come nicely after. Yeah. Later on, that'll be fine. You'll be okay.
So, because I've tried different practices and being in the room with abusive words and being when he was in the room and feeling abusive words or negative.
I'm lost completely. Sorry, what's
okay? I'm going back to what this gentleman said about how he felt like he wanted to be in the room for this person's good.
I'm sorry, are you talking about you or someone else? I'm a bit confused.
And I'm talking about the same. I felt the same thing. You know, you want to. I want to. Be in the same room with this person and have...
You want to be in the same room.
And be able to have positive interaction.
Why? That's foolish. It's stupid. It's ridiculous. You don't need to do that to change your view about him. You do it in your own mind, precious girl.
So,
you do it in your own mind, darling. You do it in your own mind every day. You work on your mind with this person. And then if you happen to meet them somewhere, you'll be fine. You don't force it. That's not sensible. That's like trying to test your fear of pythons by being with a python. Darling, is this person in your life now? I have to ask you these things now that you're talking about it. Is this person in your life daily?
Yeah.
Sweetheart, precious one. You see this person all the time. You have to see this person.
No, it's my mother.
Oh,
okay,
I see.
So it's present all the time.
Okay, so you see her often.
But
now
practice,
that you're talking about it, go on.
Right, I practice Tonglin, and then I think... I've made progress.
Good.
So that I test it again.
When you see her.
Yes.
So you do have to see her regularly. Can I ask you some questions, darling? Because it's helpful for everybody. It's so kind of you to talk about it. So these things really help. So do you want to see her every day? Or do you feel it's too much pain for you?
No, I don't want to see her every day.
Okay, good. So stop there first. See, when you say Tonglin, that's the highest of the Bodhisattva teachings.
Right.
You're leaping to kind of like be fetterer before you're even grade two. Let's go right back to simple basics, right back to humble basics, which is the wisdom wing, which is where you have to subdue your body, speech, and mind, and you have to protect yourself like a hawk from dangerous situations. So I'm asking you a question here. At the moment, so you don't particularly choose to go to see this person. And if you had the choice, you wouldn't go. Is that correct? Would that be best for your mind right now?
Yeah,
that would be the best. So why have you considered the possibility that you actually choose not to be with that person for a while? Just let me ask that simple question.
Yes, I have made that.
And you've made that decision.
I have made that decision.
But you say you're going to be in the same room as
them. Time and again. And then I try again.
You're trying too soon, darling. There's no reason to force yourself. If you can, listen, everything is up to what you're capable of. And if you feel you are capable right now of being with this person to help conquer your delusions, conquer your fears and your aversion, that's very brave of you. You'll conquer them very quickly. But some people have to make the decision because they really can't stand being around that person. They shake, they get angry, they get upset, they try to know it's their own mind, so they choose to have the courage to say, no, I'm not going to see them for the moment. So, do you go to see them because you feel bad about not going, because you feel she expects it, because you feel people will criticize you, or you keep trying to test yourself?
I keep trying to test myself.
Well, that's very brave of you. So is it not that bad when you go to see her? You don't get destroyed by it?
No, no, not
well,
anymore.
Wonderful.
It does make progress.
Well, that's wonderful.
And then I hear sometimes, like Tonglen, I have heard that before, that it's such a,
it's a really
high level.
Practice. It's amazing
and
practice.
And that sometimes I feel like I make practice, and then sometimes I think, oh, I don't know anything.
You're leaping ahead.
I should go
soon.
Back to...
Yeah, maybe you should look more into your own pain, your own
right.
hurt. I mean, you're basically angry with her? You're angry.
Yeah.
It's called anger.
Yeah,
you've
either anger.
Got attachment and you think she's
yeah.
gorgeous, or you've got anger and you think she's horrible.
Yes,
so anger. You're seeing some harm she's done to you.
Yeah.
So the first thing is to... First, karma is one thing. But the other one is to look into your mind and you know, and see that the aversion is there. Because basically, understand the aversion properly, darling, is because it's brutal. It's because
right.
your attachment didn't get what it wanted. Because during your life, this
right.
person didn't fulfill your attachment's needs. So that's devastating to us, especially when it's our mummy. So then you get anger and resentment and hurt. That's fine. But then that's what you've got to look at, and that's hard work on your own. You don't need to be anywhere near her to test yourself. You just work with yourself first and really look into how you've got this aversion and look into the anger. I mean, is it lots of anger you have with her? When you think about it, you're angry or you're fearful or what?
Yeah, there is some fear. Fear.
Okay, and lots of anger. Have you got
yeah,
family
yeah.
and siblings and daddies and uncles and aunties
yes,
who all
yes.
know about this?
Yes, everybody,
so everybody knows about
it. Yeah.
Everybody's on the same page? Everybody agrees she was mean to you?
Yes.
Does she think she was mean to you?
Probably, yes.
She thinks she was mean to you? What?
Yes.
Okay. So then, okay. So then you've got to work on yourself more. Just karma is one thing. But just take that, leave that there. And then the real one is looking into your mind, seeing the aversion, seeing the anger, the thwarted attachment. And look into this one of the, like I said before about attachment, is this assumption that I should get only the nice things, and aversion is the outrage that I get the bad things. Look into that more, because that's fundamental in all of us, in
right.
all of our dealings with everybody. Look into our hunger and our need to be seen and our need to be loved. That's the basis of so much of our pain, especially when it's our mummy. So, I mean, this. Since we're born, there was an assumption in your mind because of the karmic connection that she had better do nice things to you. And that's been shattered all the time. So you have to look at that hurt. It's true, it is hurt. It is hurt. But it's attachment. And attachment is this hungry little girl in there who only wants the nice things. So you've got to look at that and heal that slowly, sweetheart.
Right.
And heal the aversion slowly. Then you can begin to have compassion for her. Don't rush it. And it's okay to be brave. I mean, what is it? Family situations, is it?
Yeah.
Not for an hour or something, or for 2 hours. You go there for a week or what?
Right, right.
What,
yeah,
a few days? A
yeah,
day?
Funerals and,
well, then, darling,
you know, weddings and stuff.
So it's not that often.
Yeah, no, not
how
often?
Often?
Not often. Once or twice a year.
So. Oh, sweetheart, that's no big deal. So you've got lots of time on your own. But go gradually. You should know that you should pace yourself at the first level, second level, next level. And don't leap about too much and don't force yourself.
I guess it just feels like a cheapskate sometimes when I'm just feel so positive about myself, like I've made so much progress,
uh-huh.
and then
what do you discover?
You can't put it into practice.
Well, that's because you've overstated your own
right.
progress, maybe. But it's right. slow stuff, darling. Wisdom Wing is already profound. Getting rid of attachment and aversion, not even getting rid of it, beginning to understand it, is pretty profound. One step at a time, sweetheart. But looking at the assumption of attachment, which thinks I deserve happiness, that's the pain we all experience. We all believe it's true. Do you understand?
Mm-hmm.
And then when you've got that more steady, you can begin to see her more clearly. You'll begin to see her more clearly. You'll begin to see her more clearly. And then when you understand, have you ever hurt anybody in your life?
Yes.
You've done bad, mean things.
Yes.
Then when you hurt them, that wasn't because of love and kindness, was it?
No.
It's because of attachment and anger and hurt and resentment and jealousy and those things.
Yeah.
Well, that's why she harmed you. So that's one way to get close to her. In your mind, realizing the only person who harms somebody is the person who's got neuroses. And that's all of us.
Right.
When we can get that, that's kind of humbling. And whatever reason, the karmic connection between you two, really strong. When a mother can harm a child,
yeah.
that's a heavy-duty one. You must have been really horrible, it's true. In the past life. And you can take that as a joke, but also take
yeah.
it. So that shows the... Because I know myself being an angry person, and I can think of different people. Like when I was a kid, as soon as I... Were you a victim as a little girl? Were you always kind of needy and wanting mummy to love you all the time?
No.
Do you remember? How were you? Were you angry with her when she was mean to you? Or you sat there like a little mouse?
No. Yeah, I was definitely angry. Yes.
With her in return?
Yes, I was very angry.
Okay, with her in back. That's,
yeah.
that's, well, that's been good.
Yeah.
Whatever. But I remember when I was a kid and I was really angry, anybody who was a bit submissive and weak, I wanted to murder them. I mean, I understand being a bully. I understand bully mind. So bullies like victims. So if your mother could get at you, it's because you were a victim. If you were outraged and punched her right back in the face, she'd be a victim to you, I promise. But anybody who we think has harmed us, because we're a victim, as far as we're concerned, we're the victim, and we give them all the power. And that's what that dynamic is, very powerful. So when you can rise yourself up and in your mind realize that she's the one who's suffering because she's harmed you. But you know, you get anybody who's a bully and you get a person who's stronger than that person, they become pathetic.
Right.
Do you understand my point? So when you realize your own delusions, you realize hers. Right. That's a good start with empathy. When you realize yours and how they cause you pain, you'll realize hers.
Right. But that's even, you know, I don't want to ever think about her as pathetic, because then that's the other side.
What?
The other side of, like, you know, like that she's lesser than me.
No.
You know?
It's not lesser than. She's just a human being like everybody who's pathetic, because right. We've got delusions. We're all just suffering because of our delusions. We're all pathetic and sad because we've got delusions, is what I'm saying. Not pathetic meaning like derisive.
Okay.
Worthy of compassion. But right. When you know your delusions... Mm-hmm. And you know how they cause you pain. That's the key for you. Experientially, you'll understand hers. So don't force yourself to go there. Don't force yourself to have compassion for her yet. That's too high. You've got to first know your own mind more deeply and have broken hearted for yourself first. Right. Are you with me?
Yes.
So work there. And be brave and test it every now and again. All right?
Yeah.
Good, darling. Someone else then. Thank you so much. Someone else. 10 to 9. Yeah, Andre.
Yeah, I'm thinking about attachment and attachment wanting the good stuff, right?
That's right. It's really what it is. The junkie, we're the junkie for the good things.
Right. So how are we to understand a masochist?
Huh?
How are we to understand a masochist? A masochist seems to want to be hurt.
Yeah, but that's just twisted kind of way of getting attention. It's just a twisted way of attachment working. Even when we're all this self-pity kind of victim mentality, you get to see people who are real victims. It's just, that's like masochism. And we're all, I mean, the irony of ego is we're addicted to misery. We're addicted to negativity. Mm-hmm. So it's just an extra twist on that, I'd say.
Yeah.
I mean, we take exaggerated kind of masochist who wants a person to beat them up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's just, it's addiction to... It's addiction. The irony of, if we think the irony of ego, when we say ego, we think strong, but no, it's utterly pathetically self-centered. And these delusions can get very twisted, you know?
Mm.
Get very distorted.
Yeah.
That's all.
Yeah, because I meet these people in prison, right?
Yeah, I understand.
And so forth. And so I'm trying to understand them and trying to understand.
But you
like
mean
what?
The ones who've been sexually abused
and so forth, yeah. And they seem to be drawn to it like a magnet. It seemed like they want more of it.
To be harmed.
Yeah, to be
you're
harmed.
It seems to me
that's the last thing we should want, right?
Yeah, I mean, when we look at are very, very miserable, you know, like people when we beat ourselves up, when we cut ourselves, people who cut ourselves,
right,
we harm ourselves. It's the same variation. It's like just very, very intense self-grasping, intense. Attachment to misery is, I mean, we're all attached to misery. It mightn't be to beating up or cutting ourselves, but we're attached to misery. We run to the miserable. We run to the negative picture all the time. We run to the I'm hopeless and I'm no good.
Right.
It's the same thing, but it's just an extension of that. It's an extension of that, it seems to me. You know?
Yeah.
Do you understand?
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. What else, people? Yes, at the back there. Looks like Don's arm again. Yes, Don's arm.
Yes, John's arm. So this has to do with the feeling of a compassion. Sometimes we use the term, we say, okay, compassion is the wish that others could be free of suffering and its causes.
That's the technical definition of it.
Yeah, technical definition.
But you put meat on the bones of it, and when it becomes very emotional and real.
Right. And, you know, and then when we meditate on compassion, when we meditate and transform our mind into compassion, and we think about suffering, particularly of somebody we love, and then compassionate thoughts begin to arise in our mind, and then the instructions are, okay, at that point, stop analyzing and just connect with the feeling.
Yes. I'd like some correction here if I'm wrong, but just connect with the feeling, the experience of compassion, that feeling of compassion, which is really non-conceptual at that point, because you're not thinking they're suffering, may they be free of suffering, just focusing on the feeling of compassion.
Well, that's always the end result of the theory, like playing the piano. You've got to play the piano and get the experience. So here we're just trying to train ourselves, having thought the thoughts through properly, then stopping the thoughts and trying to make it experiential. It doesn't mean it'll follow, but eventually it will.
Yeah.
Eventually it will. I mean, bodhisattvas can get these realizations in meditation. Eventually it will, but not overnight. I mean, you've got to start somewhere.
Okay. Yeah, I was using the word feeling, because last night we used the word, we talked about feelings a lot, but you know, then we there's a lot of instructions.
Now we're talking about the feelings of the delusions. Now we're talking about feelings of virtues, the same thing. Then that's good. That's when they're more spontaneous. That's when it's real. You hear about people who hear about suffering and they're in tears. But most of the compassion we talk about is only suffering for poor people and suffering for dogs and things like that. Right. If we see a pedophile, I don't think we're going to cry with compassion for that person, because we don't have that level of compassion yet. Which implies you understand delusions and what causes the suffering, which is the point I'm making to you. When we know our own delusions, then we can have that level of compassion for other people. We just want to start somewhere, though, don't we?
Yeah.
That's all it means. Just give it a try. Try to be non-conceptual. Try to get a feeling of it. Isn't it? Then in our lives, it begins to grow as well, isn't it? When you read about people. And that's where the real compassion comes, when you can read about the wackos and actually go, oh, my God, that poor person's suffering. But that... it's hard in our culture, because we immediately go, what do you mean he's suffering? He's evil. We can't, because if we think, oh my God, he's suffering, we have to feel sorry for him. We've got this very naive kind of compassion in our culture. That's why we can only stick it to poor victims. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
When you begin to understand this view, and you know, look at pictures of the pedophiles, just look at the picture of a pedophile. They're the most pathetic, sad, sad, suffering person. You can't even imagine the torture, I mean, of their mind. And that's where I think we should really be down to earth. If we just look at our pathetic habits of eating too much cake, you understand? Wanting too much sex, just any object of the senses, the things that are in normal life. Look at how our minds are preoccupied with those thoughts all the time. That's what we get back in junior school and high school, when we see our minds are so demented, never stopping thinking about these things. We can't stop thinking about them. That's one of the main signs of attachment. You can't stop thinking about it. Can you imagine never being able to stop thinking about little girls and having sex with them? Your mind must be completely tortured. I've got a friend on death row in Kentucky. My friend Mitch says, and I know this guy, he comes to my classes, very relaxed fellow. Mitch says, my Buddhist friend, Rabina, he thinks of torture all the time. Can you imagine being born with the wish to jump on little boys and girls all the days? Can you imagine being born with the wish to torture? That's when we can, and we will never have compassion for that until we understand our own pathetic habits right back in junior school and high school. And that's the real source of suffering, not just, you know, the other suffering's fine, but this is the real suffering. We will only get that compassion for those people when we know our own ridiculous delusions and how they dominate our lives. And until we know that for you, you'll never understand your mummy. Don't try and force it. And this is the hardest job we'll ever do, because we don't mostly even know our minds. We're not even brave enough to admit our delusions. And we often, if we do, we exaggerate them. But we should just look humbly at the obsessiveness of our mind, the compulsion of it. Can't stop thinking about this, can't stop thinking about that. That's why our minds are so berserk and uncontrolled, and that's called attachment. Then can you imagine being born, that's the karmic one, with a wish to jump on a little girl since you're born, a wish to torture since you're born. Then you really easily, it's easy to have compassion then. It's easy, but we don't have that level, which proves we don't have enough understanding even of our own minds. That's why we can't have compassion for others. Because we're so beating us. When we've got lots of hate and anger towards ourselves, I'm a bad person, that's not compassion. I mean, compassion for ourselves is when we weep with our own suffering. Then we can see the suffering of other people's minds, and that's the real level of compassion we have to cultivate. Are we communicating, people? That's way to go. And without karma, you can't get that one, because the Buddha's view of karma says we're programmed. The second of conception, we come into this life programmed with our own past habits. That view, I mean, if you have a Christian view, that's quite shocking. That means God gave it to you. You can't have that view. If you're a materialist, you start as a blank slate. That view doesn't make sense. That's why the view of karma, which is much more integrated and more subtle than we would suggest, Link, you know. It's a primordial view about every sentient being is programmed for countless lifetimes with every imaginable tendency. And in this life, we get born with a bunch of them that become our tendencies, become our personality traits. From the first second of conception, they are there, vivid. And then we just follow our feelings for the rest of our lives, you know. Of course the pedophiles follow their feelings because it makes them feel good. Of course the person who wants to torture. I remember reading an interview about Jeffrey Dahmer, one of those serial killers from years ago. And he talked in interviews, he talked about since he's a tiny boy, he was compelled to torture little insects because it gave him pleasure. We don't get that in our culture. That just repulses us. That's exactly how karma works. The only reason we do anything now is because we want the pleasant feeling to come. So we have cakes, it triggers pleasant feelings. We jump on girls and boys because it gives pleasant feelings. And we torture because it gives pleasant feelings, whatever your habit is. So can you imagine the habit of those things that torture your mind? You go crazy, you know. That's informed by the view of karma. And that absolutely is the basis of why you'd have compassion. You understand, you know. This is a tough one. We don't understand karma. We won't know why people are born this way. We just have no reason. And you can't believe God made them that way. That sounds too cruel, you know. And we don't have that view in our culture. We try to understand why people are... I mean, I remember even with that fellow I mentioned yesterday, the one in New Orleans, wasn't it? Who showed no evidence of anger to his family, to his friends. Nobody ever saw that aspect of him. All his websites, nothing showed an inkling of anger. And there he slaughtered like 58 people. And they even examined his brain. There's not a fraction of evidence from the materialist point of view why he was like that. The only explanation you can have in the Buddhist view, of course, is past karma, this intense obsession with to kill, but kept it so hidden, nobody knew about it. And he must have had it all the time, and finally, after 50 years, he was able to do it. And but he hid it so perfectly, nobody saw it. You know? Very fascinating. Can you imagine that kind of mind? Can you imagine that kind of mind? You know? That's when you can have compassion. Because that's why people harm others. And until we get rid of the I deserve happiness, I don't deserve suffering, we can never see that, ever in a trillion years. When we realize we're all born in the same, all come from countless past lives, all get imprinted with our own tendencies from the second of conception, and we play those out throughout our life. So how fortunate we are to even have some semblance of control and even want to develop our good qualities. This is beyond incredible. So then you can be so humble about your few pathetic habits of too much cake and too much girls. Give yourself a break, please. The fact that you don't have a tendency to want to kill, steal, lie, torture, rape, have sex all day. Can you imagine the nightmare? How fortunate we are. Yes, Don.
One last thing. So compassion, when we talk about it, when we meditate and think about it, this is a lot about suffering.
And it's all about suffering.
Yeah, it's all about suffering. But as Geshe Donyo and a lot of great teachers have said, if you realize compassion, it only makes the mind happier and happier. Could you say something about that?
No, I understand, yeah. No, not as simple as that. I don't think, I'm not sure, Don, if you're saying exactly what they said, but it seems to me, the more you, first of all, have got the wisdom wing down, you know, karma, then you've got the next level down, you know your mind and deeply know your mind and delusions and why you suffer, and you've got renunciation, and you realize these things. And then you go to the compassion when you realize everybody's in the same boat. They're all tortured, they're all suffering, they're all demented, they're all causing suffering and all receiving suffering and don't know the causes. You have such unbelievable compassion for people because they don't understand cause and effect and they don't understand emptiness. That's the basis. And then when you get compassion, the next one, and this is the crucial piece, this is the unique one of the Bodhisattva path. It's called great compassion, and it's the brave attitude of the Bodhisattvas that says, it's my job to make it happen. It's my job to never give up becoming a Buddha so I can help these sentient beings stop suffering. So because already in renunciation, based on renunciation, already you're laughing and you're blissful. You see Lama Zopa laughing, right? He's hilariously funny all the time, isn't he? So that's logical. That's because he's got rid of delusions. So what makes you happy is that you're now in bliss when you've got no delusions. Even if you just realize that, you've got no delusions. But as you increase your compassion, you increase your own bliss and joy because your delusions are getting less and less and less and your virtues are getting stronger and stronger and stronger. But at the same time, that compassion is also seeing everybody else, but you never give up. So, and you even want more suffering. Lama Zad, when he had his stroke, it was almost hard to imagine. We saw videos of him in the hospital after he had his stroke, and all these Catholic nuns in this hospital could not believe this outrageous bunch of Tibetans and Roger, all laughing hilariously. He just had a stroke. And even Lama Zad was even joking even more, with even more compassion for people. It was like he was so happy to have this suffering, so we could increase his compassion. So it's kind of weird for us. So the more they get rid of delusions, the happier you get. The more compassion you have, the less delusions, even the happier you get, and the more powerful you are to never give up working for every single sentient being. So it's kind of weird for us, I agree with you. But it's the key to it is not having delusions. When you don't have delusions, your mind is naturally blissful. You can't help it. That's why they always laugh, these people. Do you understand? I mean, it's hard to put together, isn't it? Whereas we have compassion based on attachment, we weep and become exhausted because it's our attachment that drags us down to hell because attachment can't stand problems. When you've got no attachment, problems are, you eat them for breakfast. You understand? It's all I can say. It's the best I can say of it. I have no idea. I can only speculate, these people. It's time to go home. It's 9:00. Okay, you people? It's only Thursday, isn't it? We've still got tomorrow. Then the weekend. Okay, we'll try and do emptiness the weekend. But we'll do it all. Where's Wolfgang? Where are you? Put your hand up. Oh, there he is. Okay. Good. Okay. So, okay, we're done. Cooked, finished. So we think as many moments as there have been, a couple of hours, as many seeds we've planted. How incredible. No thoughts go astray. How amazing. So we maybe nourish those seeds as much as we can with our effort from this moment forward. Whatever methods we're using. Link, whatever method you use, honey, go for it. All of us, whatever methods. As Lama Yeshe says, you can have faith in Mickey Mouse if you like. Be a Mickey Mouseist. You know? Whatever. Keep moving. Keep working. Keep growing. Never give up. Never give up on you and never give up on others. That's the key to success. Gewaji nyudar lama sangye drugyurne trowa chikyang malupa jayi sala Kupashog Jangchob Semchog Rinpoche Makie Panam Kegyuchig Kepanyampa Mepayang Kongne Gongdu Havashog. Okay, thank you very, very much, everybody. So pleased to be here.